So am I still waiting, waiting, waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Revolution.
Had I not taken yesterday off, I don't know how I would have watched wrestling. I watched the first two matches on Monday, left the rest to yesterday.
Oh, yeah, that's what I usually do.
I was just, you know that feeling when you're zapped of wrestling at the end? That's where I was.
Yeah,
I had two more matches. I had The Rock, Austin, and the main event to go.
Yeah.
I was like, holy Christ, I've watched nothing but wrestling today.
I know. And it's especially, I wish I could get that light. It's especially difficult because these are like pre-taped shows without the interest, like without the relevance of current show, and also because it's on tape, you can stop it and you just feel the duty to rewind it, to watch it, to really grasp it. Whereas if you're watching it live, you just let it go and then it's done in 3 hours.
There's so many times now that I rewind stuff to be like, did I miss something here?
Oh, me too. Well, like I feel like if I'm going to talk about it, if people are going to listen to me talk about it, we should try to not make mistakes,
because we
get called out on it.
You know what wrestling feels like sometimes? Like I'm a crack addict.
We as athletes breathe every breath of our careers for nights like tonight, for nights like WrestleMania. WrestleMania to me is everything. WrestleMania is called the granddaddy of them all. And you stand on the grandest stage of them all. It's that time of year when you're on the card at WrestleMania, that you stand before millions of people and you stand before your peers, and it lets people know that you mean something.
WrestleMania is the Super Bowl of professional wrestling.
It's the World Series of wrestling.
It's like the Olympic Games, the gold medal match.
It's a tournament of all tournaments.
WrestleMania conjures up so many memories of so many special moments.
So many great events, so many great matches.
The very first WrestleMania, I watched it on TV and I had goosebumps then, just as I've had every single WrestleMania that I've had the privilege and honor of working at.
WrestleMania 3, 93,000 people in the Pontiac Silverdome. When I got Andre the Giant over my head and I body slammed him, the wrestling world stood in awe.
WrestleMania, it's fever, man.
There's really that X factor and an intangible I can't explain. You just have to feel it.
It's a feeling you really can't describe.
It's an adrenaline rush every single time I step through that curtain.
I don't care how many times you've been, it's still something that you can't help but be in awe of.
It's a time to shine and to take that spotlight and make it mean something.
WrestleMania is the time to give a career performance that no one will ever, ever forget.
WrestleMania to me is the culmination of all my hard work, all my dedication, all my sacrifice to simply be the absolute best the industry has ever, ever seen.
WrestleMania to me is the most important match of my life, something that I've lived for for the last 30-something years.
My favorite WrestleMania moment has yet to be seen.
This match, this event means everything to me.
Tonight's the night the dreams are made of.
WrestleMania is the chance to live forever.
Welcome to Review Away, everybody. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting here. Another big edition of The Law. And now it's part two, everybody. You know, I was thinking about this week, that I watched this biography on Harvey Weinstein of the Weinstein brothers.
Oh, yeah?
And
why Harvey and not the other guy?
Well, he's kind of been the one that's always been out there. He's like the creative force, whereas his brother Bob is more like the numbers guy.
Okay.
But both very, very
he's
valuable.
He's Shawn Michaels.
Yes, sure. Shawn Michaels. If Marty Jannetty, I don't know if he was the numbers guy in the Rockers.
Oh.
He got fired a number of times. But anyway, it was my first observation was that Harvey Weinstein and Paul Heyman, scary similar. But I know that's because I'm in somewhat of a wrestling bubble at times.
Do they look alike? They're both Jewish?
They're both Jewish New Yorkers who have are very outgoing personalities, and they talk about how Harvey Weinstein had this eye to find the smallest thing in movies that he can exploit to a mass audience. And, I mean, the brothers, since they left Miramax, is basically taken away from them with the whole Disney merger. Now they've started the Weinstein Brothers Company, which has been around for about 6 years, and they won their first Best Picture as this new company with The King's Speech.
Cool. I'm sold. I didn't even know they did The King's Speech.
Yeah, they were the ones that distributed it.
You got to see it this past week.
I did, and you've seen it as well. I love the movie. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I felt Social Network was still the better picture, but Colin Firth blew anyone away for Best Supporting Actor, and I thought Jeffrey Rush was fantastic in it as well.
He was awesome. See, like, this might be just the byproduct of us doing these shows, but while watching The King's Speech, I couldn't help but just think about how that story relates to wrestling, because how many times have we seen, you know, public speaking or the fear of public speaking get in the way of so many guys' pushes in pro wrestling? Chris Benoit, who, you know, has always one of the best ever to perform in the ring, but a guy who is practically a natural introvert that was forced out into a public audience and told to, you know, break out of your shell right in front of these other people for the sake of your job. And I think that movie just perfectly captured the anxiety of public speaking.
Well, look, so much, and I mean, this really speaks to Canadians, is that whenever you will hear a hockey player at an intermission, I mean, they are some of the most god-awful interviews
you
will hear.
But it's expected of a hockey player.
Exactly, and these are talented players that have been brought up with nothing but hockey. That is what has been ingrained in them from the age of 4 till they make it into the NHL. That is their full focus. And imagine they were in an industry where there was both a premium placed on talent as well as conveying a personality. Mm-hmm. Like, that seems ridiculous to an average sports fan.
Yeah.
But that is kind of what wrestling is. Yeah. You can get by with heavy emphasis on one and nothing on the other, and vice versa. But
it's almost more of an emphasis placed on the acting ability.
It is. It is very much so. I mean, those are the money players in pro wrestling. But I mean, there is a heavy emphasis at times on both.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about regular sports. I mean, I don't think you can fathom it. Just that there's, for a guy like Chris Benoit, there was never that need to cut a solid promo when he came up in Stampede or worked in Japan under a mask.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come into WCW and WWE, and suddenly that big spotlight was put on you where you had to speak. And it was a big stumbling block for him at times. So very interesting. Back to my whole comparison thing. That was my thought, is that The Law and Review Away, it's kind of like one is what Miramax was, and then they created that subdivision of Dimension Films where they couldn't do all their regular films. They wanted to do more different films for Dimension, and that's where I was going with all
that. We are the Dimension Films.
Well, we're not like Scary Movie, I hope. Hopefully we're the gems in Dimension Films.
Scary Movie was good. That first one.
I saw the first
good.
One.
I liked it.
By number...
See, Scary Movie was...
It's when they got into, like, epic movie and like that.
But Scary Movie was a movie that, actually, I wouldn't say so, but because there have been parody movies in the past, but, you know, like, Scary Movie, but for that company, though, Scary Movie was, like, the first of many in a genre.
It was really brilliant that they parodied movies that they had the rights to.
Oh, is that? I didn't know that.
Scream was a Miramax,
but they
movie.
Parodied everything.
If not, no, it was Dimension. Dimension.
But those movies parodied everything. They would like hero movie or epic movie parodied Spider-Man. They didn't have rights.
I think
that.
There's nothing against parodying something. I just thought it was always clever that you are referencing movies that are in your library and almost making them relevant to this audience again that maybe forgot about whatever. But parody has always been, especially in the U.S., it's very easy. So, feel free to parody us, everybody.
As we see every week on TNA, when they parody everything.
Well, they try to mimic a pro wrestling company poorly. Let's get into WrestleMania 19, because this is going to be a packed, packed show, everybody. Not only are we going to be joined by David Lagana, who is one of the lead writers on SmackDown at this point in time. He had just been put into that position here in 2003. But we're also going to hear comments from an interview that I did with Brock Lesnar way back in 2007, where I chatted with him about this specific main event with Kurt Angle and the spot that everybody will remember from this show. I think when you say WrestleMania 19, that is the spot you think of instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into it, everybody. March 30th, 2003, Seattle, Washington, Safeco Field. This was in my hanging out with my friends in my basement watching pay-per-view phase.
Perfectly fit the stereotype. In your parents' basement.
In my parents' basement watching this. And then I would listen to The Law afterwards.
We all do it. We all did it. And a lot of us still do it. So no shame.
What I bring that up because they would do the countdown, and when it got to zero, my thing froze, and I was pissed. I was like, fuck, you're kidding me. They're going to do this to me at WrestleMania when they've given me fucking no mercy, no problem.
Uh-huh.
But here, WrestleMania, but thankfully my box, I guess it started right out. Actually, sorry, I'm going off on all these tangents today. I missed the first 5 minutes of this and then got the rest of the pay-per-view. It was fine. I called the next day, complained about it, and got WrestleMania for free that year.
Oh.
$50 or whatever it was.
Good stuff. That's a good trade-off. But you didn't. Well, let's see what you missed.
Okay.
So this is the first time you saw the opening to WrestleMania.
This was. I missed who was billed as hip-hop and R&B princess, Ashanti, singing America the Beautiful. This was spliced in with clips of the U.S. troops, because if you recall, in 2003, it was March 19th that the war on Iraq began by the United States. War in Iraq, war on Iraq, depending on people's definitions.
It's actually Iraq.
Iraq. I'm sorry. Iraq.
Anyway, let's go on. Come on.
Jim Ross welcomes us to WrestleMania, gives a shout-out to the troops in Iraq, and encourages them to fight, and congratulates them on an eventual victory on liberating Iraq. So a very political overtone to start off the show here. But this was a big thing at this point. This was 11 days into this invasion.
Mm-hmm. And especially with the WWE, they'd like to really promote the idea that they are for the troops, they should.
A slice of Americana, as they always say.
What I wonder if this aired in Iraq.
They usually have it on the Armed Forces Network, so
I don't know. I wonder if it aired in the Middle East, because at the time there were a lot of people against the war, and
There was a huge, even this early, there was a lot more people in favor of it. In fact, I got into a giant argument in my English literature class about this.
Let's hear about this.
No, I don't want to go into
it. But what I mean is, the WWE, maybe not at this time, but now we see they're heavily relying on the global market. And I wonder if that idea played into any concerns regarding this type of,
Oh, you mean in terms of being... but... I mean, WWE is
an American company, absolutely.
Yeah.
This arena looks wonderful. I always loved the outdoor arenas. I wonder, was this the first outdoor arena since 9?
Yeah.
That they did?
They've only done it 3 times. Mm-hmm. This actually, didn't they have, was this like a full, I know it's a baseball stadium. Isn't it a dome, though, at the top?
Well,
I don't think
Safeco
Field was an open field.
Oh, okay. But there was a lot of sunlight going in there.
Yeah.
And I just thought it looked fantastic.
It's always great when, like, a big stadium show, I think always it looks really like this is the major leagues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really gives that impression off throughout the whole event. We got this epic opening video with the wrestlers talking about WrestleMania and its importance, past memories. And it ends with Jericho saying, WrestleMania is the chance to live forever.
Sure.
So, Tuck Everlasting kicks off, brought to you by Snickers Cruncher.
Tuck Everlasting?
Didn't you ever read that book in grade school?
No.
It was about the ability to live forever.
Okay.
And if you would choose to live forever, if you had the choice. Never mind.
I've never read.
Grade 4 for me. And the theme song.
I've learned so much about you, John, about your personal life, just in the first 10 minutes.
I need to keep the stories to a minimum because I know how much stuff we have to go through today. The theme song for WrestleMania 2003, when it was not a PG product, was Crack Addict by Limp Bizkit. So we have a drug reference and a dick reference in the artist's, in the band's name. So congratulations. And, oh, I won't say Limp Bizkit was the low point of this show, because the low point was extremely obvious on this show, but Limp Bizkit, fuck.
I didn't mind this song. It It really grew on me.
See, I'm not one who... I did not hate Limp Bizkit. It seems everyone is like questioning, how is this band ever allowed to produce music? I thought, you know, 99, 2000, they had their little mini run.
Nookie.
Yeah.
Nookie was an awesome song.
And let's not forget...
Break stuff.
For wrestling fans, I mean, My Way was a gigantic hit for wrestling fans, but I hated the Crack Addict song. Okay. I just couldn't stand it.
I don't think even... up until this point, I had listened to the entire song in its entirety, because you would only hear the chorus or the hook. But this song is it's really shitty to start off.
Where he counts and builds up to the chorus, where he yells, "I'm addicted to crack."
But the hook itself, I thought it worked really well in the promos and in the build to Mania.
Yeah, I get it. For spots, yeah, it was did lend itself well to that. This was also post West Borland Limp Bizkit.
Mm-hmm. They actually here for this performance, they had Head.
Yeah,
Brian Head Welsh from Korn.
That's who they called in. Big gig here in Seattle. Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler are on the Raw announce team, with Lawler making reference to Jim Ross's John Wayne cufflinks that he brings out every year for WrestleMania. And then we go to Michael Cole and Taz on the SmackDown side, and that's where we're going to kick things off, with Matt Hardy, accompanied by Shannon Moore, defending the Cruiserweight title against Rey Mysterio. The Matt facts appear. Matt is appearing in his fourth WrestleMania, and then the other one is he wonders how they did WrestleMania without him.
Yes. That's great.
They did it without him last year.
Yeah.
Was he in the Money in the Bank last year? I can't remember.
I don't know.
He might have been. We see a corkscrew plancha right away by Ray to Hardy and Moore. Oh, we should mention Ray's outfit.
This was Ray's first WrestleMania, so he came out in maybe the first custom outfit that he's ever introduced. And this was a play on the Daredevil movie that... I don't know if it came out before.
Yeah,
or was
it did come out before. And the theme song for Daredevil was Evanescence.
Oh.
Bring Me to Life.
There you go.
At least all the commercials ran with that, too.
It all revolves around Evanescence.
From a horrible movie to a rushed match we go. This was like a 15-minute match condensed into 5.
Sure.
Because Mysterio was going to get his shit in this match. Mm-hmm. That was what he was determined to do. Corkscrew plancha right away onto Hardy and Moore on the floor. Moore then stops Mysterio from delivering a powerbomb off the apron to Matt Hardy. Hardy ends up going shoulder first into a turnbuckle and then takes a springboard seated senton from Ray. Gets set up for the 619, but Moore trips Ray, and then Hardy hits a nasty twist of fate onto Ray, where he gets angled onto his neck badly, taking it. Mysterio then is set up for a splash mountain off the second rope by Hardy, but he counters it midair into a Hurricane Rana.
It looked fantastic.
This was crazy, and even more so, everyone remembers the Ray and Eddie match at Halloween Havoc, where they did this off the top rope. Matt Hardy was coming off the second rope, and it was like even less room for Mysterio to counter and apply the Hurricane Rana, so this looked great. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was a fantastic potential finish, and instead it was just a spot for Moore to put Hardy's foot on the rope and then dropkick Ray.
Well, like Matt was supposed to go over.
Yeah, he was to go over. I just questioned, like, that was like a big spot you might want to save for another finish down the road. But anyway, Hardy gets drop-kicked into the ropes, gets hit by the 619. Then Hardy ducks the West Coast pop by Mysterio off the top rope. Mysterio goes for a victory roll, but Hardy stops on top of Ray, grabs the bottom rope, and gets the win. Very quick match, and you know, not a bad match by any stretch. These guys worked really hard with the limited time they were given, but just a very rushed match because there was a lot on this card.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, I was a big Ray fan at the time, and he had a great year coming into the WWE, and so I guess I had my hopes pretty high for this match because I was a fan of Matt Hardy as well, and you know, like for an opener and a packed show, you can only have so much time, which is unfortunate because I was actually really looking forward to this match. But it's still a very good opener.
Because, one of the reasons that some of these matches had to be shortened was because you had to make time for the real celebrities who were drawing the spy rate. The Miller Lite Catfight girls showed up in a limo, and their gimmick is that they argue. And these two were in a Super Bowl commercial together. Have absolutely no idea what they ever did after the Miller Lite commercial, but they did get to go to WrestleMania this year and got a lot of on-camera time.
Mm-hmm.
So we will go back to them. Don't you worry, folks. We then get a replay from Sunday Night Heat, where Big Show and the A-Train leave Nathan Jones laying out in a shower. Very odd message that was subtly given.
They just...
At least he was clothed. Tony Chimo then introduces the WWE's favorite band in the whole entire world, Limp Bizkit.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the reaction to this was booze. And they were able to actually work in WrestleMania's Right Here into the lyrics of their song as Fred Durst is dropping F-bombs all over the place that WWE is trying to censor. They could say shit, but not fuck.
Mm-hmm. Well, on pay-per-view, you can't say fuck?
I guess not. They censored it here.
Okay. So they performed Role in here, not Crack Addict. And of course...
That was going to be later.
Yes, and of course this set up for The Undertaker's entrance because he used to come out to this song. By now, Taker had actually switched to that, shitty country song.
The one we shit on and then people defended. They liked it. I did not like that.
Whatever. Anyway, Undertaker comes out here and it was a really nice touch. I think Undertaker saluted Fred Durst or something, and so...
Well, he also had the American flag on his motorcycle.
Yeah.
So maybe, maybe he was saluting Fred Durst. Thank you. Thank you for performing my theme song.
I just love the idea that Taker is down with Fred Durst. Kid Rock.
We have a whole email here on Fred Undertaker Durst and his alliances.
Okay.
So that brings us to second match of the Nightway, Undertaker in a handicap match against the Big Show and A-Train.
What do you think the reason was behind the Nathan Jones injury angle backstage?
They had no confidence in this guy to work a match.
Which is awesome. Which is great.
I loved how they realized this the morning of WrestleMania. That, wait a minute, we can't put this guy in a tag match.
He sucks.
He was horrible. And thankfully, the whole story with him was they went on a tour of Australia, where he's from. Mm-hmm. He was like, I'm not coming back. I'm done. So he got a free trip home and just stayed there and went on to be in that movie with Brad Pitt.
Oh. Okay.
Some gladiator theme movie. I don't know.
I know. Troy.
Troy, that was it. We should note that even here in 2003, the streak really didn't become a big deal until I think Randy Orton kind of brought up the streak in 2005, and they started referencing it. But
what was it up to at this point? Because the year prior, he beat Flair, and that wasn't that 10?
That was 10, so this he'd be going for number 11.
Right. So it's, 11.
Yeah. I always remember that WrestleMania where he beat Flair for 10 and went to put up his hands for 10, and you could see the arthritis in his hands where he couldn't even open his hands. It's like, this guy's hurting, and that was 9 years ago. Taker immediately goes to chokeslam A-Train right after Show goes over the top rope, and we get Taker yelling at the two, "Come on, motherfuckers!" That was not censored. Michael Cole notes that the streak is in serious danger. I question that. He hit the old school to A-Train. Taker then walks into the derailleur by A-Train, but A-Train, rather than pinning him after hitting his finish, which is by definition the finish, he threw Undertaker to the floor.
Hmm.
I question this. Why wouldn't you just beat Undertaker? You would go down in the annals of time as A-Train, Matt Bloom, stopping the streak at 11.
Maybe.
At 10.
Maybe he knew his finish was weak.
Show drops Undertaker onto the barricade on the floor. Then Taker makes a comeback with a series of punches, counters the chokeslam into a Fujiwara armbar on Big Show. Crowd had no idea what he was doing. This was broken up by A-Train, who then gets put into a straight armbar, but that was broken up by Big Show, and they got the heat back. Then we saw a long abdominal stretch by A-Train, which was reversed by Undertaker. Taker then came back with a series of running clotheslines into opposite ends of the ring, took a bicycle kick by A-Train, the brogue kick before it was the brogue kick, and then takes a chokeslam by Big Show. Then Nathan Jones gets his WrestleMania moment by running out, hits a spin kick on point to Big Show. Didn't fuck this up, which if I was so scared to put this guy in a tag match, I would not have booked him to deliver a spin kick. But nonetheless, he hit it, got into the ring, hit a big boot to the A-Train, and the ref called for a DQ and Undertaker's streak ended. No, the ref just watched Nathan Jones come in and attack A-Train. Taker then hit a tombstone on A-Train, which was quite the feat in and of itself, yeah, being how big A-Train is.
See, okay, he watched him attack A-Train, but he was technically supposed to be a part of the match. Does that still call for a DQ? Well, I suppose that was the logic behind it.
I guess, but they still only announced Undertaker as the winner.
Yeah, and okay.
Nathan Jones is our first Scott Putski candidate of the night, and I swear we will name a winner at the end of tonight.
Okay.
Okay, so let's keep track, okay? Nathan Jones, this guy looked disgusting. Like he had an air pump inside of his body that he had been fully pressing all night.
Okay.
He was huge. Cole ends it with, Nathan Jones and The Undertaker could be a force to be reckoned with.
Yes.
And the streak continues, Way.
You know, I gotta say, considering the participants, this match was better than I expected. Everybody worked hard, Taker especially. He had to work with as a single guy against the Big Show and A-Train.
On any other pay-per-view, this probably would have, no one would have had any complaints with, but this was on like the deepest card of the year, and that's the only reason I think people will point to this as maybe the weakest match of the night. But
sure.
By no means was this like embarrassing.
Nope, absolutely
and
not.
You're right, Undertaker worked really hard in this match. The Miller Lite girls are walking backstage, and they meet Tori Wilson and Stacy Keibler and welcome them. They compliment Tori on posing in Playboy, and they compliment Stacy for her marketing campaign of the testicles, which are Test's fans. Mm-hmm. And she's done such a great job that she couldn't get them on WrestleMania. Great job, Stacy, but you're here. Jim Ross cuts a promo for the U.S. troops and wishes them a speedy fight and to come home. Then they replay Sunday Night Heat with the Dudleys attacking Lance Storm. It was a tag match with Lance Storm and Chief Morley against Rob Van Dam and Kane. But then they drop an elbow onto Rob Van Dam, so Storm and Chief Morley kept the tag titles on Sunday Night Heat. This match was originally scheduled for the pay-per-view, and Lance Storm has talked about this, that it was like the day of, due to timing, they put them on Sunday Night Heat, and despite being billed on the card for WrestleMania, they did not get a WrestleMania payoff.
Oh, no.
Which sucks. It's like,
yeah.
What's the logic there in that if you were promoted as being on the card, people bought the show assuming your match is on. Not that this match probably added any buys.
Okay, but just the very idea that Nathan Jones got a WrestleMania
payoff. Miller Lite Catfight Girls got a fucking payday.
But not Lance Storm and RVD and Kane. It's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So,
but the finish was, I didn't understand. I forget what happened here.
It was just the Dudleys basically attacked both.
Both,
and
yeah,
led to Storm and
but what was the program that they broke off into after that?
The next night, the Dudleys won the tag titles.
That was it.
We then go to our third match of the night. Three-way for the women's title. It's Victoria, accompanied by Steven Richards, defending the women's gold against Jazz and Trish Stratus. I was always a giant fan of Jazz. I thought she was great. This match starts off strong. Victoria yanks the leg of Trish off of the apron and sends Trish to the floor. Victoria hits a somersault into a leg drop over the top onto Trish on her throat. Jazz and Victoria then hit a double backbreaker spot to Stratus. Stratus hits a roll-up bridge onto Victoria. Victoria then holds Stratus as Jazz hits a spin kick, but Stratus ducks and she hits Victoria. Victoria breaks up a fall after Stratus with a chick kick to Victoria. And then Trish Stratus runs into the corner and hits her turnbuckle Hurricane Rana. And it should be noted here, she grabbed the bottom rope here and performed it flawlessly. Whereas at No Way Out, or Elimination Chamber, she grabbed the bottom rope, and I thought that was why she fucked the move up.
Does she not usually use the bottom
rope? I always thought she used the second rope. But in this, she used the bottom rope and hit it fine. Okay. So I think it had much more to do with what she was running. She probably had no momentum running in those heels.
Sure. And I mean, I'm sure, you know, the nerves from coming back after such a long time perhaps may have gotten to her. But yeah, I'd
say
mostly
the heels. A lot of that spot is you got to run into it. Imagine running with heel boots on. Like, that's terrible.
Yeah.
So nonetheless, she hit it great here at WrestleMania and likely will at WrestleMania this year, hopefully. Being that they don't put her in a high heel match.
Okay.
That could be like a play on words in a high heel match. Anyway, where do we go here? Jazz put on a half crab after Victoria took a spill onto the floor and then transitions into an STF onto Trish. Richards breaks that up with the ref checking on Victoria. We see a roll-up by Trish to Victoria where the crack of Victoria was revealed to 54,000 people and 565,000 people on pay-per-view. Victoria then misses a moonsault onto Jazz and then hits a back body drop to Jazz, who is then taken out of the match. Richards runs into the ring with a chair. It bounces off the top rope and hits him into the head, the Kurt Angle goof spot. And then Stratus delivers a bulldog to Richards. Victoria attempts a widow's peak. It's countered. Stratus hits her chick kick to the midsection of Victoria and gets the win. I thought all these women worked really, really hard. And if you look at where the women's division was, like 9 months before this period.
Compared to now,
it's a joke.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, with Fit Finley getting involved, and I know Lance had a big help with a lot of these women. 2003, to me, was the standout year for women's wrestling in the WWE. Mm-hmm. And these three had a huge connection to all of that. Molly as well.
Led by people like Trish, people like Jazz, people like Victoria that really had a passion for the in-ring work. And, you know, you could see it here. They had a very good match, and everybody hit their spots great.
Yeah, and as we go back to, a lot of people will say, well, the WWE just recruits models now. They don't know how to work. You know what? Like, Trish and Victoria were models as well that were brought in, and they worked their asses off to become very competent workers. So that's why I never buy with the model excuse, is that those two came from the exact same world. I mean, they were not doing matches beforehand. Victoria came through like UPW, got trained. Trish was rushed right into the spotlight on Raw. So anyway,
this was the Law was her training.
Yeah, she was doing her training with, like, you know, on national TV and then working with Ron Hutchison like on her days off. Yeah. So Jonathan Coachman is backstage with The Rock. He says that the people can chant sell out. And that's what he's done at every WrestleMania he's been in. He's sold the place out. And he says this means everything. With Austin beating him twice. And the one thing he has learned in Hollywood is that Act 1 and 2 don't matter. The only thing that matters is Act 3. And says that tonight will end the greatest rivalry and be the final chapter. And this was a much more serious promo than what his character was doing, what we had seen a month ago at No Way Out, where it was all
mocking
comedy heel stuff. Right, was a pretty serious promo from The Rock.
I really liked it. I really liked the line about the axe.
I always remembered that line from The Rock. I was like, that was just a great, great line and worked very well here. And he also was able to put over the match without saying that there's no more challenges for me in the locker room. It was we'll get into this during the video preview for that, but Rock basically cut the exact same promo as Hunter on TV building this up, stating that I've done everything I've set out to do in the WWE except beat Steve Austin at WrestleMania, and it eats at me every day. Mm-hmm. Like, he just said the exact same fucking thing without having to bury anybody. Mm-hmm. Amazing. We then go to our next match, Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas, defending the tag titles against Chavo and Eddie Guerrero and the team of Chris Benoit and Rhino for the tag titles. And they mentioned that Benoit and Rhino both missed WrestleMania last year due to neck injuries. And in fact, all six of these guys were not on the 2002 WrestleMania card.
That's right.
So this match, I thought it was another match way where they had to rush through a lot. They got under 10 minutes here. So that's obviously a disadvantage here when you have many workers in there.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that two of the participants here, Benoit and Eddie, would go on to end WrestleMania next year as the champions.
Yeah, and here there was actually talk because of Kurt Angle. His neck was just fucked going into this show. And there was heavy discussion about Angle missing WrestleMania and dropping the title to Benoit to defend against Lesnar on this show. So Benoit at one point was even penciled into main event WrestleMania this year.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get into more about that with Dave LaGuardia.
Yeah, he can speak to that a lot better than us. Benoit and Eddie are in their early, just insane chops from Chris Benoit. And then there was a spot where they seemed to bump heads in the middle of the ring. Cole brings up the angle on SmackDown where Eddie injured his shoulder. And Taz basically says, yeah, forgot about that. Benoit and Rhino work on Haas, and then Team Angle gets the advantage on Rhino. Taz shuts down Cole for continually referring to Team Angle as nervous. Taz just, like, gets sick of this point Cole is making. He's like, okay, we understand they're new. They're not nervous out there. They seem to be doing fine. Just shut up. There's a press slam. This was a cool spot where Benoit basically hit a press slam to Eddie, dropped him onto his stomach, and when he came down, applied the crossface, and then Chavo made the save.
Yeah, it was like a flapjack into a crossface.
Yeah.
It looked great.
There was a head scissors by Eddie to Shelton. Benoit comes in, hits three German suplexes to Chavo, who makes a blind tag to Shelton, and as Benoit isn't looking, he turns around into a super kick from Shelton and goes for the pin, but Eddie makes the save in that account. Then we see Rhino gore Charlie Haas, then gores Chavo, but then Rhino is pulled out of the ring by Eddie, and Shelton is basically just the last one in the ring with a downed Chavo who's taking the gore, gets on top of Chavo, and gets the win, and Team Angle keeps the tag titles. This match, on paper, if it was given more time, I think would have stood out a bit more, but mm-hmm. they were a victim of time and just a lot of bodies in there for a short amount of time.
And like what you're really saying is it was not a classic, but it was still a very good match.
Still
for the
very
undercard.
Good. Yes, undercard. Absolutely. Not too much you can complain about.
As was the norm for SmackDown at this time. And again, Dave will speak more on that.
And once again, you bring up the fact that Haas and Benjamin, they had been on the main roster for 3 months at this mm-hmm. point. Like, mm-hmm. that's just incredible that they were in a match like this.
And they completely, hung up with Benoit, Guerrero, Rhino, all these veterans. They didn't seem to miss a step at all.
Back to the Miller Lite Catfight Girls Way. This is what, like, segment number 3 with them. The women are taking photos and jumping up and down. And Keebler says that Vince invented WrestleMania. Now, Tori says, Hulk Hogan was the one that made WrestleMania what it is. And then they argue back and forth, just like the Miller Lite girls argue. And it's like the most contrived arguments where they just say their point over and over again.
Mm-hmm. They really spent a lot of time on this.
Well, then the Miller Lite girls, first the WWE chicks left. So then the Miller Lite girls argued, with one saying McMahon, and then the blonde girl, who apparently didn't know Hulk Hogan's name, repeated his name, but pronounced it like Hulk Hogan. Hogan. So I have pulled this clip in case you doubt me, folks.
You know, Tanya, Stacy's right. Mr. McMahon did create WrestleMania.
No, Hulk Hogan did.
No, Mr. McMahon.
Hulk Hogan.
Mr. McMahon.
Hulk Hogan.
You know, this is WrestleMania. Let's settle this cat fight in the ring.
Let's settle this in bed.
What? In the ring.
In bed.
In the ring.
In bed.
Fine.
Fine.
So yes, this was quite the argument. And why this did not get redone with the pronunciation, I don't know. But this sucked. And at least they were consistent all night
long. I wonder if there was some deal with Miller that said you have to give X amount of TV time to these
two.
Oh,
God. It's like, fuck it. This is what Lance Storm didn't get a payoff for.
Oh, man.
The Miller Lite Catfight Girls. We get a video for the Shawn Michaels-Chris Jericho match, and the build-up for this, I thought this was the best build going into WrestleMania. It all started with a super kick to Jericho back in December on Raw, and they air old clips of Michaels at WrestleMania, build this up as his return to WrestleMania, and then they showed pictures of a young Chris Jericho doing like identical poses as Shawn Michaels did. They juxtaposed their same moveset of Jericho trying to be like Michaels.
Wearing the same tassels that Michaels used to wear as part of the Rockers.
And it all leads to Jericho saying that everyone used to call him the next Shawn Michaels, but he wanted to be the first Chris Jericho. And then there was an angle where Michaels and Christian were going to give a concerto to Stacy Keibler. Michaels made the save and then takes a chair shot and juices to set up the WrestleMania match. And the whole storyline is who's better.
The storyline is as simple as it could be. Jericho thinks he's the next Michaels, and Michaels says, prove it. That's all.
Amazing. And there were no poop jokes, and there were no
spilled coffee.
No tweet pictures.
Yes.
Amazing. And that leads us to the match between the two. Lawler mentions that the cameras are here filming WrestleMania the movie, which I know Way wants to chat about a bit later on. And that was a documentary they were filming that would eventually air as it would be an extra on the WrestleMania 20 DVD that mm-hmm. Both of us have had a chance to see. So we'll chat about that afterwards.
The documentary, you could see throughout the filming of the main events on this show, this guy with a huge camera. It was actually a film camera with reels of film on it. And so, yes, this WrestleMania was perfectly, very well captured in this documentary that we'll chat a little bit about later.
Yes. Jericho makes his entrance. I remember this being really cool because it was the first time he wore those new tights. Mm. I always like when guys, you know, for a big, big show, they've got new tights or something.
Sure.
It just makes it look like a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Then Shawn Michaels comes out. This is why Shawn Michaels might be the greatest performer of all time, because if this guy wasn't so fucking good with the theme music, the dancing, the outfit, I don't know how people could like this guy.
The confetti guns.
Oh, he comes out and he's like jumping up and down like a 5-year-old wearing like a stripper outfit. And like, this is what some dude would look like at 4 a.m. after a night of heavy drinking. Pulls up these confetti guns at the entrance to shoot out, like right out of Johnny B. Badd circa 94. Mm-hmm. One of them was broken circa WCW every year. And then they cut to Chris Jericho as Michaels is walking down, and you see Jericho just give the middle finger to Shawn Michaels. So great. Anyway, this entrance by Shawn Michaels, it was like,
terrible. I guess, you know, they want to put over the fact that this guy is Mr. WrestleMania. How do we show that? He shoots confetti.
And he gets on his knees and prays. This period of time from when he came back and did that Survivor Series match mm-hmm. with the ugly boots and tights to this, like, his fashion sense is like the worst in wrestling.
He used to have a great look. He used to have an awesome look in his original run.
And a year or so after this, he would kind of just get to a normal look. But at this point where he was still wearing the tights, he had that short haircut that was like, fuck, he looked like a lesbian. I don't know. I'm not trying to be offensive here. You know what I mean, though?
I know exactly.
Like, you can pass as a woman.
I know. I know exactly what you mean.
I know I'm not offending anyone because I don't know. I know no females listen to our show, so I'm not offending anybody.
You look like a lesbian. Oh God, you're funny. Fuck.
So let's get into the match. Jericho's knocked to the floor and takes a baseball slide from Shawn Michaels. Jericho goes for a running face plant, but he's thrown into the turnbuckle crotch first, and it leads to a figure four leg lock by Michaels. We see Michaels skin the cat and use a head scissors to take Jericho to the floor, and that led to a Walls of Jericho that Chris comes back with on the floor, and they somewhat tease Michaels not being able to make it back in time, but gets into the ring. And this leads to Jericho having the heat in the match, working on the lower back of Michaels. Jericho hit a flying forearm and then does the kip-up to mock Shawn.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michaels does the exact same kip-up and makes a comeback going on offense. Michaels would hit a moonsault for a near fall, and it led to a series of back-and-forth pin attempts from a sunset cradle. Michaels would block the Walls. Then Jericho finally hits the lion salt but only gets a near fall. Michaels goes for a hurricane rana. It's blocked, and Jericho again applies the Walls of Jericho. Michaels makes it to the ropes. Jericho goes again, but Michaels gets an inside cradle for a two count. And lots of great back and forth spots here between the two. It was just kind of one trying to outdo the other, which was the whole story of the buildup of this match.
Yes, and I think it was a little bit subtle because the announcers didn't really pick up on it until the middle or the later parts of the match. But Jericho was focusing a lot of his attacks on the lower back of Shawn Michaels. Which is, of course, you know, the site of the injury that Michaels had, and also the region that the Walls of Jericho attacks. So I think that was a very nice touch from both of them.
Jericho went for a back suplex off the top rope to Michaels, but Michaels countered it in midair into a cross body for a two count. Michaels brought the crowd really into the match with this top rope elbow drop, and then he goes for the sweet chin music. Jericho ducks and applies the Walls. Crowd is really hot for it here, and Jericho does the spot where he pulls him into the middle of the ring, but Michaels still fights back and eventually grabs the ropes. Jericho's very upset that Michaels would not tap out, and then blindly walks into a super kick. Michaels crawls over for a pinfall, but Jericho kicks out. Michaels then takes the flip bump into the corner, comes back, and gets a rolling crotch hold and gets the win here out of nowhere, not using the super kick, and it's got a very, very big reaction. Mm-hmm. And the post-match saw Jericho, he teased that he was crying, goes to hug Michaels, and then low blows Michaels, who basically holds on to Jericho. This was like right out of a Greek tragedy.
I thought it was so good. Just the look on Jericho's face as he looks like he's about to cry. The crowd starts applauding that these two are hugging, and then bam. It's like... It's so obvious, but it's like the type of dick thing that somebody would do, but then afterwards, you applaud it.
Oh, yeah, and then Jericho basically just shoved Michaels like from the face, just knocked him down to the mat. It was a very cool visual.
Yeah.
And it was like, this was perfect for Jericho. Like,
yeah, in the end.
Where would you have gone with him if you did the respect at the end?
Sure, and like you feel like you hate the guy, but in the end, were you not entertained? And then you realize, yes, I was very entertained, and then you actually applaud this.
Now, at the time this happened, there was a lot of criticism because everyone thought Jericho should have gone over in this match.
Mm-hmm.
And because even at this point, no one knew how long Shawn Michaels was going to be around for. I mean, it wasn't like he was wrestling every week, but he was definitely increasing his schedule. But, you know, in hindsight, Jericho kind of... He made it anyway. And
yeah.
I think this was a fantastic match. Probably...
Yep.
We can talk later about the match of the night because there were no shortage of candidates.
Absolutely nothing absolutely nothing bad you could say about this match.
Yeah.
And then really, in the
end, I really enjoyed the finish where he couldn't beat him with the sweet chin music, had to go to an alternate move, and it was like almost that alone increased Jericho's stock.
Yeah. And I don't think it matters who went over because they both went over with the quality of this match.
It was a great, great match. And this is where the show basically from this point onwards was pretty solid because they had built this show. It was a really, really deep card. I mean,
the talent roster at this time was, Hogan, Rock, Austin, Angle, Lesnar, Taker.
You can make the argument.
Benoit, Eddie.
Yeah. Like, even looking at WrestleMania 17, if you're to take a combination of in-ring workers and name stars, you could say this was the most talent-laden WrestleMania in history.
Sure.
And probably still maybe. From top to bottom, like... This is definitely one of the better shows. Sylvain Grenier walks into Vince McMahon's office. What a horrible segue from what we just said into Sylvain Grenier.
Sylvain Grenier gets a WrestleMania payday.
Amazing. A promo airs for Bill Goldberg coming to the WWE, and all it says is that he will be in action at Backlash, and the crowd was just buzzing after this in the Safeco Field. This was the first time this promo aired. And you know what? Had Goldberg never shown up on TV and they just... left his debut to Backlash, fuck, would that show have done great.
They could have played that video week after week.
But instead, the same guy who scripted John Cena to call poop jokes into the WrestleMania main event got involved in that program. And by the time Backlash came, it was not the success people thought it would be. Amazing.
That's for another review.
Yes, it is. They announced the attendance at 54,097. Which they state as a new record at Safeco Field and a legit number, we should add. And then they introduced Limp Bizkit to perform Crack Addict and once again introduced him as the WWE's favorite band. I just wrote here, this song sucks, and I fast-forwarded. They played the whole fucking song.
Well, yeah.
This was the tag match.
What are you going to do, play half a song?
Between this concert and the Miller Lite shit?
I completely agree with you that this... has no place on the show. And the reason is because music tastes are so subjective. When you put on any band, I mean, the greatest band in the world, okay? Death from Above, 1979. You put them in WrestleMania.
Mr. Uozzo.
You're bound to alienate a large portion of your audience that doesn't care about the band. And to spend 5 to 10 minutes on something like this, I think it's a bad move, and I'm glad they don't do it anymore.
You know, it's funny. I was watching this week the trailer for the WrestleMania Story DVD, and they're just showing, like, it's just clips of all these memorable moments, and they show, like, Kid Rock performing, and they show these celebrities. I'm like, that is the sole reason this stuff is on WrestleMania. It's for these nice packages, and it makes them seem like a giant pop culture company rather than just wrestling, which, with all due respect to, you know, the tag titles, that is not going to be remembered. And I get it when you want to put this in, but just as a fan watching, concerts just... I hate watching them at wrestling shows.
I hate it when people try to do it in MMA with that Affliction show, and they put Megadeth on. Totally killed the pace of that card.
You're right. Yep. But we keep going, everybody, because this was almost like the unofficial intermission. We got the Limp Bizkit performance. Then we got press conference highlights of Tori Wilson appearing in Playboy. Says, this was almost creepy. Tori says this is the sexiest she has ever looked. What a vain bitch. Huh. Then Stephanie McMahon is interviewed and says that Tori has the best body she has ever seen, and you have to see the inside pages. And it ends with Tori saying, quote, "This is me in the raw." How creepy would you be talking about your naked body? And having your female boss talking about how you are the sexiest, the best body you have ever seen. Very creepy.
I don't know. I can't relate to it. My boss has never commented on my body. So I don't know what it would be like.
This is just the weirdest highlight pack I've ever seen in the WWE.
Hey, what else are you supposed to say when you want to promote this?
Well, this, for instance, granted, this was like 2 minutes, but it was like, This is why would you put this on a pay-per-view? Even WrestleMania,
you want to promote it. You want to sell.
When you put it
copies
on TV with the, like, you know, three times the audience,
didn't
at
they?
Least
didn't they do that?
Well, they did, but whatever. Who cares? It's a very small point to make. It's 2 minutes. It's not like the worst thing in the world. Because that was next. Jonathan Coachman asks if people are ready for a WrestleMania catfight, and introduces the Miller Lite catfight girls, and it's the first time we're introduced to their names. Tanya Ballinger, who was the blonde, and Katana Baker, the brunette. And there's this giant bed that, like, Giant Gonzalez would have slept in and had room. Stacy Keebler then comes out before and says that the only thing better than three girls in bed is... Oh, I fucked that up. The only thing better than two girls in bed is three, and makes it a triple threat pillow fight. And guess what happens next way? Tori Wilson comes out and makes it a fatal four-way. Everyone's shirt gets torn off. Tori's wearing a pink bra. We see a roll-up by Tori to Keebler so that everyone can see her ass, and Tori spanks Keebler. Then they roll over Jonathan Coachman. Coach gets pantsed. Keebler pins Coach, who I'm not even going to complain was not part of this match, and they attack Coach with pillows. All four women pose with their backs towards the audience, and they leave together.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like the eighth TV I've destroyed since we've started these reviews.
I understand the criticism. Wrestling should be about wrestling.
You can't make any argument to me why these two Miller Lite girls should have been on this.
It's just an excuse for titties. That's the excuse.
You could have done that without those two. These two were so fucking bricks between the ears. Couldn't you have done something with like a stripper match with Keebler and Tori?
I agree that the three skits, three vignettes beforehand were a little unnecessary, but as a little short segment, this was just stupid fun and not really offensive.
I'd go so far as to say, and we'll probably have a better idea reviewing more WrestleManias, this could be maybe the worst segment in WrestleMania history.
No.
What would be worse?
Well, I'll have to dig back, but
okay.
Come on.
We'll start with
man, that Sid Taker match comes to mind.
Well,
there have been some bad ones.
All right. We get a video for our next match. It's Triple H against Booker T. And they talk about Booker's upbringing with his mom dying and getting in trouble with the police. And they show the greatest mugshot of all time with Booker with the biggest smirk on his face after he was arrested. And the build-up for this match, everybody, if you were watching at the time, you were watching in 2003, were you?
Well, I was watching off and on. I wasn't watching as closely as I was, but believe me, I know everything about this.
The build-up to this was like Triple H was this bigot who called Booker a common street thug, said someone like you doesn't win world titles, even cited his nappy hair on a television interview. There was another where he was like in a towel and he threw money at Booker to do shit as like his servant.
Said,
very, very racist.
Said people like you are entertainers and only dance. So dance for me. You're not a champion.
They spliced this comment in where Hunter said that WCW was a joke where he won his five titles. And then Booker comes back and says, some of the things you say are true. And then they show Booker pinning Hunter on TV on the Raw heading into Mania, and they tease that Hunter is doubting himself going into this match. The build for this sucked.
This is the infamous Triple H racist promo.
Yes.
And so that was some great heat, John.
Oh, yeah. And great heat.
Here's the payoff.
Unfortunately, no one told Seattle. Triple H came out, did his entrance solo, and then all of a sudden Ric Flair was in his corner. I don't know where he came out from. Maybe he was in the audience. And matches for the world title. Lawler mentions that Booker has Johnny Cochran on speed dial and then reinforces that WCW is a joke. And Jim Ross is like, well, did you ever work in WCW? Lawler says, no. Well, I did. And I can tell you that, yes, it was a joke. Mm-hmm. The fuck?
Well, those are his... that's obviously a line, but maybe very well Jim Ross's own personal thoughts.
That's fine, but this you're promoting your world title match, and the babyface has always... He represents being a WCW champion. You're basically saying your babyface was a joke champion, and he's come now to the big leagues. This, to me, buried Booker in this match. And it's even worse because of the outcome of this.
See, I
really hated the commentary in this match from both guys.
Well, yeah. But the idea behind that line, Jim Ross should have said that because he has very true feelings about his experiences with WCW. What he should have said, though, and what they should have said, what the whole program should have said, was even though the company was a joke, Booker T was not. And that's something that they didn't necessarily put across.
I disagree. It's not just like WCW is this renegade company that went out of business. It's a company that you bought and that you had a vested interest in promoting.
Yeah, I understand.
It's like the war's over and you've won, and now you've got to sell WCW products by their tape library.
We've all said that, but we both know that they would never let that up. Vince would never let that up.
Well, that's an entirely different argument. But I couldn't believe that, especially for this build-up, where that is Booker T's biggest claim to fame was being a WCW champion. You just present this company as a joke. It's like it's your company now. WCW is under your ownership. That's how we started. Lawler brings up Booker T being born on a pool table. Ross asks, where did you hear that from? Howard Finkel? He was drunk last night. This is the world title match at WrestleMania, I once again say.
You know, Lawler is playing a pretty different character here. Just
racist.
In this match.
He said he has Johnny Cochran on speed dial.
Sure, yes. Okay, whatever. But that was the program. It was racism. Lawler was playing a heel here, completely siding with Triple H, whereas in the other matches, he wasn't. I didn't really understand that.
Booker T hit one of the most, outside of R-Truth, the most unimpressive skin the cat I've ever seen, where he held onto the ropes and just climbed back up the apron while holding on to the top rope.
What are you saying, John? What are you trying to say?
Don't start. Booker gets thrown into a steel post by Hunter. Ross criticizes Hunter being given the title and says there should have been a tournament rather than him being given it. What's going on in this match? It's like he sounds like us. Ross says Lawler isn't a stranger to a courtroom, and then they get into a racial discussion with Lawler saying that people like Booker don't become world champions, and Ross says, what do you mean people like Booker? Hunter hits a spinebuster for a two count. Booker makes a brief comeback to zero reaction. Then he goes to the floor. Flair attacks Booker and throws him knee first into the steps, and Lawler comes back and says, oh, Flair was just trying to help him back into the ring. And Ross cuts him off, saying that line went out in 1982. Hunter applies an Indian death lock, which Jim Ross goes apeshit for. He cannot believe he is seeing this in 2003.
Well, he puts it over really well. He did a good job.
Yep. They did a cool spot where Hunter hit an Irish whip, but Booker couldn't go into the turnbuckle because his leg gave out from the Indian death lock. Booker gets a sunset flip out of nowhere, but is stopped right away by Hunter. Goes for the pedigree, but Booker blocks, teases a ref bump, but twice they avoid contact to the referee. Booker hits an elbow and then a scissors kick using the bad leg.
Mm.
Then Booker climbs up on top, gets Flair twice, tries to stop him, but Flair gets knocked down. And then Booker, on his bad leg, hits the Harlem Hangover, where it looked like he landed on Hunter's head.
Mm-hmm.
There's a delayed cover, but Flair puts Hunter's foot onto the ropes. Hunter comes back and out of nowhere hits a pedigree. They're both selling. Hunter remains on his back for about 5 years, and then crawls over for the very delayed pinfall and gets the three count.
Okay.
This was like, Hunter came off as like the racist babyface that triumphantly won here.
The racist wins. Yes.
Okay, let's talk about that a bit later, but the match itself was not a good match. The finish was terrible.
It was really bad.
Booker T lost via a bounce off the ropes. He bounced off the ropes, and yes, into a pedigree, but he bounced off the ropes with no offensive attack. It was totally anticlimactic. The hangover was botched and made no sense considering the injured leg. And yes, the racist won.
The racist won, everybody. And I know a lot of people were outraged, but looking at this logically, Booker was not ready for the world title at all, in my opinion. Now,
sure.
That totally makes the storyline stupid with the buildup that if this racist is going to prevail at the end, it's horrible. I completely agree with that. I hated this program. I thought the match really underperformed. And yes, the crowd had a big part in that, but there was a reason the crowd was down for that. They were, it's not like this crowd was burned out, because look what came after this match, which they were huge into.
I still think Booker should have gone over, though, because of the racist.
What do you do then
angle?
When you know you're going in the direction of Goldberg eventually? Then you're just flipping the title.
They weren't necessarily pairing Goldberg with Triple H.
No, he was coming in early with The Rock. Yeah. But I mean, what, you would have had to get the title back onto Hunter, because that summer they were going to go to Goldberg.
Okay, eventually. But for the end of this program, you had to have Booker T get some revenge on Hunter for saying those things. You just had to, as a public company, as a company that does stories.
Well, in the long run, it had
the racist was
zero
triumphant
impact.
Here. Name me one TV show in the world where a racist came out on top.
There was plenty of them, I'm sure. I can't think of any.
Come on,
WWE.
Even in, never mind. Anyway,
it's just wrestling. Who cares?
God.
It was, I don't know, I just didn't enjoy this match at all, to be honest.
By the way, Hunter would later go on to say that he was only referencing Booker as a former convict.
Oh, well then that clears everything.
Yeah, sure.
Dance for me, convict. Convicts dance. Promo airs for, Jim Ross ends it by saying Hunter's been in the match of his life as Hunter collapses on the floor with Flair yelling, "The greatest of all time!"
Yes.
Promo airs for WrestleMania 20. It's coming to New York City in 2004. And then they plug Limp Bizkit again with their album, which comes out in June, that I never bought. Then we get a preview for Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan with old clips of the two. They show Hogan defeating the Iron Sheik in January of 84, WrestleMania 1. They argue over who created Hulkamania. Says that Hogan walked out on him with WCW with a clip of him appearing on Nitro. And then footage of the 1994 steroid trial with Hogan testifying and McMahon calling him a coward.
And
they went all out here.
In all this footage, McMahon is wearing a neck brace.
Which
looks so funny. It looks like some bad footage from some 80s sitcom.
Well, he had a neck injury and just happened to need a visible collar during the biggest trial of his life.
Yes, they did go all out. Yeah. Recapping 20 years of history here.
I do remember this one angle on SmackDown that I loved at the time, and I don't know what that says about me as just a normal human being, but they did a contract signing where it ended with McMahon stabbing Hogan in the forehead with a pen and then grabbing the blood into the pen and signing the contract in Hogan's blood. I just thought it was the greatest thing ever.
Yeah, it looked great. The music here in this video was really different from all the other ones, because it was, rather than, you know, being super energetic and rock, it was like a really moody, sustained chords that were calm but give a tense feeling at the same time.
I agree. I thought each of these videos, I thought they had a distinct
style,
theme and style. Mm-hmm. It was like we had the, you know, teacher versus student with Michaels and Jericho. We had this as kind of the two creations of WrestleMania, mm-hmm. the amateur theme, the clan membership with Hunter. So, all contrasting.
Yes.
So that brings us into this match, everyone, which we should note, going into WrestleMania, you know, Lesnar Angle went on last. It was the main event technically, but Hogan and Vince was what was promoted as the main event. That got the heaviest emphasis, I thought, on TV. I mean, the poster, you pick up the video or DVD now, it's Hogan and Vince on the front. And conversely, the show, it did a very, very disappointing number on pay-per-view. It was like 565,000 buys.
Do you think that was the reason?
I totally think that's a huge reason for it. They did like 850 the year before for the Mania in Toronto. So that's a giant drop.
I wonder why. I mean, on the same... do you think the poster and the promotion makes that big of a difference?
I think just... Yeah, I think what is pushed the hardest is going to have an impact on people. I think Lesnar and Angle in the right build-up could have been really big. I think Austin and Rock even would have gone ahead. I just think a lot of people, they are into the Vince McMahon character, but spending that much money at WrestleMania to see
on
Vince
a match
McMahon
that
wrestle,
you know is going to be shit.
Yeah. So I think that hurt. Internally in the WWE, they felt that going to a small market like Seattle really hurt them, and that's why for the next few years they went to New York, they went to L.A., they
Hold
went
on.
To Chicago.
Why would that hurt their buy rate?
They felt that in the last few days, being in a smaller media market, there's less buzz on the show and national media presence.
Really?
Building up the show. That's why you look...
Is Seattle that different from being in Miami?
I think there's a noticeable difference. Like, the Pacific Northwest is, you know, it's a very smaller pocket. And I mean, to me, outside of last year's one in Glendale, Arizona, they've kind of stuck to big metropolis cities.
But to me, like, WrestleMania is just such an international event. And all the media that I usually hear about it anyway is mostly just from watching the WWE. So
I don't buy into that as that being the reason why the number was down. I think it's a reflection of your build and a reflection of what you put forward. And I thought,
and just the business cooling in general.
Yeah, I just think, you know, Hogan and Rock was something really unique for the previous year, but Hogan and Vince, I mean, it was a decent build, but I mean, that
two very limited guys.
Very limited guys. So let's get into the match. It starts off with a Vince McMahon, clearly a candidate.
Hogan, absolutely.
Hogan, I would say ditto.
You know, I often forget how tall Vince actually is. I mean, we always know that he's a, you know, very muscular guy. Like, he's the winningest champion of the Scott Putski Award. He's won more than anybody.
Vince?
Yeah.
More than Luger?
Yes.
Oh.
I think he's won four times or something like that. But I never...
He's consistently jacked for his matches.
Yes. But I never consider how tall he is. He's like almost as tall as Hogan is here. He's like 6'3 or 6'2. So I look at that and I guess I can understand better why he
The big
likes,
man mentality.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because like he can look at a guy like Evan Bourne and say, how can I take you seriously as a serious competitor when I dwarf over you? You can't even beat me up.
I think that is a huge part to do with it. Vince slaps Hogan, and Hogan comes back with the absolute worst double leg takedown I've ever seen. Vince bumps off a clothesline, which had to have been seen to believe. It was like this guy was ran into a door he didn't see. Taz cites that Hogan is attempting to ground and pound McMahon. They did a lot of easy stuff for heat, like test of strength spot.
Which is smart.
It's booking to your strength.
Yes, exactly.
Simple shit, but the crowd was into this.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that was the biggest thing of this match is that you can criticize the work, the crowd reacted. And that, to me, that's my always answer I go to, is that if the crowd reacts, it works.
I've personally found it entertaining because the characters were so strong, and also they made great use of gimmicks.
Vince might be one of the least athletic people you see, just, I mean, finesse-wise and moves, but, man, when that guy...
His timing is excellent.
That guy is going to work as hard as any... or attempt to work as hard as anybody. Like, that guy tries to compensate for everything he comes up short with and just really tried hard in this match to make whatever worked. They go to the floor. Vince poses in front of Hogan. Then grabs a chair, but Hogan ducks and Vince hits the steel post. And then Hogan tosses Vince headfirst into the post. And then Hogan gets the chair and hits Vince with an unprotected chair shot, allowing Vince to juice. And I think this was the first blood we had seen on the show up to this point, right? Was there any blood earlier?
I don't know.
I don't think there was. Cole brings up the fact that, let's not forget last month in Montreal. And I was thinking to myself, no, let's forget about it.
I've already forgotten.
We see a chair shot to the back of Vince by the announcer's table. Then Hogan swings the chair at Vince by the Spanish announce table. Vince ducks, and Hugo Savinovich takes a chair shot to the head, and this would take him out of WrestleMania. Vince comes back and hits Hogan in the head with a chair, and then pulls a ladder out. And Vince hits Hogan with a monitor, puts him on the Spanish announce table, and then delivers a leg drop off of a ladder onto the announce table.
Yeah.
And puts Hogan through it. The crowd yells, holy shit.
Uh-huh.
Vince no McMahon kidding. Pulling this off was just insane.
What I found funny about this match was that Vince was the workhorse here. I mean, Vince McMahon going up against a guy who many people, one of the most, if not the most popular wrestler in history, Vince McMahon was the workhorse here.
He took more of this match.
Oh, yeah.
He was the one that was kind of just dictating.
Mm-hmm.
He was the ring general in here with
Hogan. He was. He really was.
Oh, it says a lot. Hugo is juiced here, and then we see him taken to the back. And this is where I where does the Spanish announce team broadcast to? And what happens when they are taken out of the broadcast?
What do you mean, where they broadcast to? It's the SAP feed.
So when they're taken out,
there's only one
what
guy.
Happens?
I guess there's only one guy who does the fills in. Maybe they bring a fill-in.
All right. Hogan is back into the ring. Vince gets a two count here after that ladder spot. Then he climbs out of the ring, grabs a pipe, and then in perhaps the greatest shot in WWE history, the camera is tight on Vince, peering up from the apron with the deadliest look ever with his eyes. And it just zooms out on Vince with this maniacal look.
Mm.
And I just remember seeing this shot at the time. I thought that was just fantastic mm-hmm. that they caught it. It just looked tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
Hogan,
you know, like, and just thinking about that, it really is a testament to the production team here. The fact that a camera guy can catch that, the fact that Kevin Dunn can see that and say, go, take that right there. It's so hard, really is so hard to capture these moments.
Kevin Dunn was the hardest worker in this match.
Sure. He always does a fantastic job.
Hogan stops a pipe shot with a low blow to McMahon. Then a large ogre in a black jacket climbs in. Just like you couldn't see the head. It had this round style. It looked like a monk running into the ring. And it's revealed to be Roddy Piper, who gets in. Now, I should have rewound this. Did he spit on Hogan as he got into the ring?
I would think not.
I would think not too, but I'm pretty sure Cole said that he did. Anyway, I could be wrong here. I'm sure I'll be corrected. Piper gets a massive pop. This was a legitimate surprise because Piper had spent the last like year just downplaying the WWE and just ripping on them.
Mm-hmm.
And gets a huge pop, starts kicking Vince McMahon, then he lifts the pipe. And this was like the Vince Russo swerve to a fucking T.
Fuck.
Where he's just waiting and waiting. We got the prolonged look. We got the side of his eyes looking for when Hogan would stand up. And then Hogan gets up.
It was like he was still in WCW.
And he shifts his hips, which have been replaced, and attacks Hogan with the pipe to a gesture of boos. And he makes a reference to kiss his ass and leaves the ring. And all this was a spot for Vince to get a near fall because Hogan kicked out.
Yeah.
So didn't even play into the finish of the match.
I didn't understand this. I didn't know the relevance of Roddy Piper at the time. I don't know if he played a part in the build to this at all.
He didn't play any part of the build in this match. And coming out,
what is his association with?
Well, the deal was this whole match was presented as 20 years in the making. Who uh-huh. made WrestleMania? And Piper got involved saying, uh-huh. I was the one that was helping to make Mania. I think storyline-wise, it makes logical sense.
Okay, but to come out in the middle of a Mania match in a program that's not yours, completely unannounced, and to no effect here in the end, I didn't think it was necessary.
It was a surprise pop. I didn't mind it. Brian Hebner stops Vince from using the pipe, which I couldn't understand why, because we had established there are no rules. It's a street fight. So why was he stopping him from using the pipe?
It was too much.
Okay. Vince just tosses Brian Hebner out. The first time he failed throwing him outside, so he then threw him to another part of the ring, to the floor. And then Vince waves down Grenier, who is only identified as the Montreal referee. Mike Sparks, another referee, comes down as well and argues with Grenier. We don't know what happens, but Grenier ends up in the ring. McMahon hits a leg drop, and then Hulk comes back, does the Hulk up spot, hits these terrible punches to Vince. Vince is knocked down. Then Hulk throws Grenier out, hits a big boot to Vince, and then hits three leg drops for the win. And after the match, Shane McMahon walks down. Hogan, later in interviews, tried to play this as a shoot. That
Shane walked down.
He's like, we had worked the match, but we had not planned for Shane to come down to the ring. That was legit, brother, what you saw. That was reality.
I was like, shut up, Hulk.
And Shane just checks on his dad, and they were subtly teasing something here with Shane and Hogan that went nowhere.
Yeah, I didn't see a reason for this either.
I thought for what this match was, of the limitations, mm-hmm. I thought this worked. The yes. crowd was really hot for it. They took tons of shortcuts, and that's how you book these two.
Absolutely.
You book them to take shortcuts, give them blood, give them a street fight. Vince did the big ladder spot.
Give Hogan.
Surprise pop with Piper. It was like you booked every shortcut imaginable to keep the crowd into this.
Exactly. Just turn Hogan into the Superman that he always plays. I mean, look at what he survived. 5 chair shots, a leg drop off a ladder through a table, a random Roddy Piper heel turn, 2 steel pipe shots, a leg drop from Vince, and a crooked referee.
The Montreal referee.
But, you know, it totally worked. And if you go in with a mentality that this is not going to be a 5-star classic, this is just going to be a Hulk Hogan match, a typical Hulk Hogan match, then it was definitely fun. I had fun watching it.
If you were to watch this on mute and just analyze a match, like move by move, mm-hmm. and the Hunter Booker match probably was technically better, but in terms of how it came off, there is zero comparison,
yes.
in my opinion.
Yes.
Zero comparison. We then get the video for Austin and The Rock detailing Austin leaving the WWE the previous year with the infamous Austin took his ball and went home, that mm-hmm. Way is a big fan of. And Rock saying that Austin could take his ball and go home. And then this is where the promo aired that I mentioned about Rock saying he's done it all except defeat Austin at Mania. And then they do the whole montage to Crack Addict.
Which was which brought up memories of that My Way video.
That's true.
From X7.
One of the greatest cut videos in WWE history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we get into the match away, we should go over what happened that weekend with Steve Austin. And it's absolutely incredible that this guy performed here. The night before, he was rushed to the hospital. Austin knew this was going to be his last match, which it has turned out to be,
mm-hmm.
but didn't want it promoted as such. Basically,
didn't tell many people.
Very small circle were mm-hmm. aware of this. Like, you're probably talking Rock, Vince,
Jim
JR.
Ross.
Very small circle were aware this would be his last match. So in the weekend leading up, apparently the day before, he had been drinking an excessive amount of, yes, coffee mixed with ephedra. Like energy drinks and shit. And you can imagine what this did to his heart. Mm-hmm. And he ended up being rushed to the hospital. He had to stay overnight because of, I think it was like an elevated heart rate.
Yeah.
Like a serious deal. This wasn't just some, okay, you need to cool off. This was fucking serious.
They were at heart attack levels.
Yes.
Heart rate.
Like
the night before.
He stayed overnight and was discharged Sunday morning of WrestleMania and then came to work this show in front of 54,000 people. In no other sporting event would someone be allowed to do this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wrestling is just like its island when it comes to this. Like, there's no way Austin and Kurt Angle are working this match in any other kind of commissioned sport.
And we'll get more into this with the next match as well, which is an even better example, in my opinion. But yes, the WrestleMania documentary definitely goes into detail about this and presents this whole story really well.
Yeah.
It really just showed Austin and the contrast between Austin and The Rock at the time, who was in perfect health, who was completely excited for Mania, whereas Austin, he came into the building just wanting to get this over with.
Yeah.
It was both men's last matches, but for Steve Austin, he just wanted to survive. He was risking a whole lot here just to be doing this match.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that after the after we finish the review here, because I definitely want to talk about that.
But what we're talking about right now, I'm totally gripped into this match knowing what we know, knowing the inside story behind it. However, if you just watch the build for this match itself, I thought it was really weak.
It was really pushed more so on what we've done. Like, this is just, it's Rock and Austin.
Yeah.
And they were relying on nostalgia.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you had Rock out there playing the guitar.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there was still a lot of comedy stuff, and they were really relying on, this is a rematch from past WrestleMania. It's like, it was promoted, you know, the greatest rivalry in WWE history once again. And it was a lot on more just cachet than on what they're going to be doing. So I agree with you. If you looked at the real life situations here,
mm-hmm. It was so much more compelling. Like every bump that Austin took, you start oohing and aahing.
Yeah. Ross and Lawler come back and they really put over the McMahon Hogan match. Austin hits a barrage of shots to start the match. Just really starting off at a very fast pace. Teases the stunner right away, but Rock escapes outside. Austin attacks him on the entranceway and make their way to the SmackDown announce table and brawl onto the table. And it's all Austin early on in the match. Ross enforces that Austin is a wrestler, and that is what he was born to do, to contrast to The Rock, who is off making movies at this point. Rock clips the knee of Austin to make his own comeback. They fight on the floor, back inside, and Rock applies the sharpshooter, with Ross bringing up the WrestleMania 13 match with Bret Hart. Austin reaches the ropes to break that up. Rock throws the leg of Austin against the steel post. He had both knees braced in this match. And then they brawl in the ring, ending with a double clothesline. Austin comes back with a Thez press and tons of unanswered shots that I thought Hebner would actually stop the fight if this was a UFC fight. Rock's head was lifeless from just selling these shots. Then Austin hits a elbow drop and gets a two count. Rock stops Austin with a running forearm and does a kip up to booze. Austin gets back up, and then Austin hits a rock bottom for a two count. This leads to The Rock coming back and catching a kick by Austin, spins him, and then Rock hits a stunner onto Austin as they exchange finishes, and he gets a two count on Austin. Ross, at one point in this match, just gets sick of Lawler plugging WrestleMania the movie and says, "Can you just shut up about that? How many times are you going to plug that thing?" Which is just very funny to hear. We get punches by The Rock. Austin ducks the last one and then finally hits a stunner, gets a two after a delay for a big pop. Austin shoves Earl Hebner, and this allows Rock to hit a low blow. Rock misses his first people's elbow, but then hits a second attempt, and that leads to another kick out. It's just all based on near falls here at the end. Austin walks into a rock bottom for a near fall, and Ross is just one of the best calls I think he's ever had for an Austin match here.
Mm-hmm.
Added only by the fact he did know that this was his final match, which the audience didn't know. Austin, I really enjoyed this, where he was just struggling to his feet after these rock bottoms as Rock was just waiting to hit him with another. Austin fights off another rock bottom attempt, but Rock then gets a second attempt and hits his second rock bottom. Again, Austin kicks out, and Rock is clearly frustrated here. Once again, Austin is selling the effects huge as he gets back to his feet. Again, Rock grabs him. There's this brief pause, and then he hits a third rock bottom, and that is the one that gets the win. And this, I thought these two just worked their asses off in this match.
Sure, especially knowing what was going on with Austin at this time. You can't help but compare this to their previous matches. And I
don't have it at the level of 17.
Absolutely
to me,
not.
That is their best singles match ever.
Well, yeah, but consider, I completely agree with you, but let's consider the circumstances here. The build wasn't as good as it was for 17. The company wasn't as hot, and the spot on the card wasn't as important. And obviously, the participants weren't as healthy. So, you know, there you have it. In the end, it really does seem like a pretty unfitting way for, you know, two of the biggest stars in the company to leave. When you think of the great exits in recent years, you think of Shawn Michaels, you think of Ric Flair. They had fantastic final matches. Here, it was just sort of a whimper for Steve Austin.
I don't know. First of all, Austin didn't want the big send-off.
Yes.
So,
yes.
I mean, that right away didn't want any of that. Secondly, I mean, The Rock was kind of, it wasn't like he was leaving here. I mean, he was even sticking around for the next pay-per-view, and they were under the assumption he'd still come back every now and then. And with Austin, I mean, he was just... I wouldn't have put this match on last, to be honest. And it's almost like the focus is, well, we're losing these guys, whereas Angle and Lesnar, these are our new workhorses, mm-hmm. and these are the guys we're focusing on now.
It makes perfect sense, and Austin goes into this in the documentary about how, you know, his mentality was he didn't want to tell anybody because he didn't want it to be a big deal, because in the end, this was just a job for him, and all it meant was that him leaving just opened up a spot for somebody else. That's all it was to him. He's not a guy that gets emotional. But in terms of business, imagine promoting this as Steve Austin's last match. What you could have had there. The amount of emotion you could have had there.
After the match, Rock is just sitting there next to Austin on his back. And he shoves Earl Hebner away. And you can see him talking to Austin. And he kind of goes into this in the documentary. Mm-hmm. And then they...
You know what he says?
He said he loved him, among other things. And then Rock left, posed. He went and celebrated with his family, who was at ringside. And after Rock leaves, Austin's music plays as he exits. And probably none of those people had any idea what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very interesting in retrospect. And when you look at retirements, I mean, very, very tough for Austin. Like, look at the amount of money he was walking away with at that point. And how much money he's turned down subsequently how many WrestleMania offers do you think he's gotten over the years since 2003? Sure. Working a match with Hogan, working a match with Orton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every time he said no, like he's got more than enough money to live off.
Oh, yeah.
Ross has even made the joke that of all the money he's invested, Austin could probably live off the interest of the principal of what he saved, and just doesn't want to risk taking that one bad bump that would fuck his neck up forever and be a quadriplegic.
Which is the smartest thing.
Austin's an incredibly smart individual, yeah. I think, and not a mark for the fame or a mark for himself. And
he comes across as like incredibly honest in his interviews these days.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's one of the most credible guys when he does an interview, that he's not going to just pander to a WWE view. He's very honest in his interviews, and someone has a lot of credibility with people. So that ended the Raw end of things for the night. And then Michael Cole and Taz, they sell the last match as they throw to the main event, and we get the preview with Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, featuring Lesnar winning the Royal Rumble. And then they showed the television leading up to it, where there was a gauntlet match on SmackDown where Lesnar beat Benjamin and Haas, and this would allow him to face Kurt Angle. And right as the bell rung for that, Heyman runs in and hits Lesnar with a chair to end the match in a DQ. Then they profiled the switch, where Lesnar starts beating on what was supposedly Kurt Angle in a hoodie. Awesome angle.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the reason for that match in the first place.
Yes, yeah.
They had actually promoted the WrestleMania main event 3 weeks ahead on SmackDown and actually gave away the match for free on SmackDown. And the reason was because Angle was just fucked here. His neck
was completely fucked at this point. He was scheduled to go in for surgery right after WrestleMania with Dr.
Joe.
Originally it was going to be Lloyd Youngblood, and he would be out for a year. And that was the plan. He was going to be out for a year. And it was only after WrestleMania that people learned he was going to go for the minimal invasive surgery that would keep him out for a much smaller amount of time. But at this point, everyone was under the impression Angle would be out for a year. His neck was completely gone.
He only had 20% strength in his left arm.
Yeah. And they decided, they went to Angle. He said he wanted to work WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And I remember going into this match, I didn't even want to watch it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I really thought something terrible was going to happen in this match.
But originally, they even went as far as to book the title switch on SmackDown 3 weeks ahead of Mania. And you mentioned earlier that Benoit was perhaps going to take Angle's place here. But at the last second, like you said, Angle decided he wanted to stick around and do Mania. And I just think about the scenario here. You have Kurt Angle risking paralysis to compete in the main event of WrestleMania, and against a relatively green guy, no less, in Brock Lesnar, who was huge, didn't know his own strength.
Yeah.
And was coming, you know, basically main eventing his very first WrestleMania. A really nervous
first time
guy.
In front of a stadium.
Yeah.
A huge, huge pressure situation. And unfortunately for 99% of guys in this situation, well, first, the majority, I think, well, this being pro wrestling, I think it would actually be a smaller number of guys who would willfully give up the main event at WrestleMania because of health. But even those who went ahead, I mean, you would probably get a pretty simple match and more of a let's get through this rather than put out a top match. But with Kurt Angle, it was like, your neck is fucked. Yeah. He's still going to go out there and work a Kurt Angle match, which was just nuts.
You know, like, that's definitely the story with Kurt Angle. And you can understand why maybe he's not welcome in the WWE anymore, because the passion that this guy has for professional wrestling is like, it's almost dangerous. You know,
it's incredibly dangerous. Yeah. And I think it's no different than with all the discussions right now about whether it be players in the NHL or just any sport right now with concussions. It's that you ask an athlete if you're okay to go, 9 times out of 10, they're going to say, I can perform.
Well, Jorge Rivera from that UFC fight.
Exactly. It shouldn't have been left up to Kurt to decide this. It should have been, listen, Kurt, this is terrible. Mm-hmm. We know you want a main event WrestleMania. We are not in good forget good conscience. Think from just a simple business perspective. If one of your guys goes out there and were to be paralyzed in the ring, knowing you sent him to the ring in the health he was, WWE is not only open to a lawsuit, but think of the public relations to that.
They've been through that.
A public company sending a guy who is in need of complete reconstructive neck surgery into a match where he's going to take moves right onto his neck.
Yeah.
It's incredibly irresponsible. But that's kind of the culture that is... You know, you just people are applauded for this, and it's you're working through this, and it's great that this guy was that much of a team player, but at the same time, what if Charlie Haas were in the same situation and wouldn't want to go out there? Well, Kurt went out there and worked with a bad neck, and you're not going to go out now with a bulging disc in your back. It just creates a trickle down effect for all the guys to have to follow this. Mm-hmm. So you can look at the good and the bad of it, but it was a very hotly debated topic going into WrestleMania of whether he should have been allowed or not. Anyway, that was the switch on SmackDown was all that. Lesnar got into the ring, destroyed this guy with the hoodie on, and we all thought it was Kurt. It was revealed as Eric Angle with a shaved head, and that Kurt basically ran in, switched with Eric, and then rolled up Lesnar to retain the title. So every week you were tuning in, the smart fans were anticipating a title change, and then they'd swerve it at the end where Kurt kept the title. Mm-hmm. It was very captivating television if you avoided the spoilers, and a very interesting build-up based on everything that was happening out of the ring. And this match was basically ruled by Stephanie to have no interference, and the title change could change on a DQ or a countout to ensure that Team Angle didn't get involved in the match. And that is where we go. Michael Cole's voice was completely dying at this point after calling the action. Which
what did he call? What
was his last? As I look back, it's not like he was calling 3.5 hours of action. It was like half of that.
You know, and this was Michael Cole's first WrestleMania main event, and so maybe that played a part in it. You know, feeling all the pressure of having to live up to the years of Jim Ross doing it. I thought he did a good job, though.
I thought so. I thought him and Taz were a great compliment to Ross and Lawler. Very distinct commentary teams at this time.
And by saying he did a good job, I mean I wasn't noticing him, you know? Like, he stood in the background and called the action like a play-by-play guy is supposed to do. That's what you should consider a good job for someone in that role.
He's always going to be in... People are going to listen to the final 5 minutes of that Austin Rock match and listen to Jim Ross. And no one can call a match like Jim Ross in that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Michael Cole included. I mean, very few are able to call a finish like that. And I think Michael Cole will always be compared to that. But I thought, especially at this time period, was Michael Cole's best.
Mm-hmm.
Lesnar comes out. He has taped ribs on, selling the angle from SmackDown over the last few weeks. Angle, they mention, has lost 7 pounds in his intense training for this match and is at 230 pounds. And this was the start of this match. It was unlike any of the other matches on the entire card. They start with chain wrestling. They're exchanging holds and doing almost like an amateur-style start to the match, which I really enjoyed.
In a later interview, Angle would go on to say that Brock was really worried about not having enough time here because I guess they were originally scheduled for like 30 minutes, but then because they were running short on time, they cut them down to like 20-something. And so Angle was just saying how Brock was just really tense and nervous this whole time, and Angle thinks it in the end it affected Brock's performance.
That's interesting. Angle transitioned and started working on the ribs of Lesnar. He hit a German suplex early on to Lesnar and then continued to work on him, delivered a German suplex right into the top turnbuckle. Then Angle gets on his back with a rear choke. Lesnar eventually powers out of it. Angle remained on offense. We see a running knee to the back that knocks Lesnar to the floor. And then Lesnar cuts off Angle back in the ring with a spine buster and then an overhead suplex. Angle came back and hit four German suplexes on this neck.
Yeah.
Keep in mind. This was the match where you kind of mentioned it with Austin. For me, when I watched this live, like I was cringing every time I saw Angle do this. I was just lost at why this was happening. Angle runs into a back body drop over the top rope. Then we saw Angle run into the corner. He missed Lesnar and comes back with a released German. And Lesnar flips all the way over and lands on his front. Then Angle hits an angle slam for a two count. Angle teases another angle slam, but Lesnar counters with an amateur roll-up for a two, and then they get back to their feet. Lesnar finally hits an F5, but only hits a two count, and you could see Angle taking the F5, kind of like, instead of face first, he was kind of shifting his body to avoid any impact on his neck. Still incredibly dangerous, no matter where you're landing there. Angle comes back with an ankle lock and pulls Lesnar into the middle of the ring. Lesnar drags Angle as he reaches the ropes. Lesnar then kicks out, knocking Angle onto his back, landing right on, like, near the neck at that point as well. We see Angle get a small package for a near fall. He goes for the angle slam again. Lesnar blocks, hits his second F5, but doesn't go for the pin and instead eyes the top rope. Angle is out way too far. Like, you can tell even before you knew what was going to happen that Angle looked out to be really far on top of the fact that Lesnar just worked 20 minutes here.
Yeah. And this was to be the greatest moment in WrestleMania history, this spot.
This 300-pound monster hitting a shooting star press.
Well, for the longest time, since Brock Lesnar's debut, a clip of him doing the move in OVW has circulated around the internet, and everybody was just oohing and aahing, and wow, look how perfect he does this move. He does it so well. I wonder when they're going to pull this out on TV. And rightly so, they decided to do it here, in the biggest moment of the year. It was supposed to be the greatest moment in WrestleMania history.
You'll hear way more about the circumstance of this move when we air our interview with Lesnar, including whose idea it was, because it wasn't Lesnar's, and how he was kind of talked into it, basically, to do. We'll get into all of that. As everybody knows by now, he went for the shooting star, nearly killed himself, landing neck first onto Angle, who was out far, and it looked just terrible. Like, I thought he was dead when I saw this.
Yeah.
It was incredible.
From the
height he was coming from, with the amount of size this guy was driving onto his neck.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, Lesnar was moving. Angle climbs on top of him for a pinfall where Lesnar kicks out.
This was Kurt Angle's very first instinct. I mean, even Angle, he's mentioned that he thought Brock was paralyzed after this. And yet still, within a millisecond, his very first instinct was still to stay in character and go for the cover. I think it was so amazing that Brock even had the state of mind to kick out right here.
I'm amazed. Like, what if he hadn't?
Yeah, then new champion. Or retaining champion.
Angle called the audible. Lesnar somehow made it to his feet, hit another F5, and he got the win. They show Lesnar completely glazed, cannot even stand up at this point. Like, he was not there. Taz is calling this the greatest WrestleMania of all time. Angle and Lesnar shake hands and hug after the match with pyro going off. Lesnar was just completely out of it.
He couldn't even hold the belt.
They couldn't do the beauty shot with him.
No,
like, on the ropes.
They couldn't. I mean, I just, going back to what you said about just how strange pro wrestling is, in this closing moment of WrestleMania 19, what are we watching here? We're watching a man who just suffered a huge concussion, forcing himself to stand in front of a crowd of 50,000 people, trying to come to. Like, the severity of a concussion in any sport is treated with so much care. So much care. Yet in pro wrestling, there's the idea that you have to do everything you can to hide it from the audience. And not only hide it, but still continue to perform.
And then afterwards, we can get into the documentary right now. Afterwards, I mean, Kurt Angle had this, like, insane come down from this. He was basically going on adrenaline here, and he was, like, having convulsions backstage, mm-hmm. and just his body went into shock. Mm-hmm. Lesnar was completely fucked up after this match. He had to be taken to the hospital where he was just messed up from this concussion.
Yeah. He was never concussed before. He was never knocked out before in his life.
This was, like, the most, I don't even want to say the most physical WrestleMania, but I mean just the repercussions going into this match and coming out of it for these guys who just, this to me was the glaring point where, I mean, you had just seen Benoit miss a year, Rhino had missed a year, Edge was off this show with a neck injury, Angle was about to take time off, Lesnar nearly killed himself on this show. Mm-hmm. Austin was retiring because of neck problems.
Yep.
This, to me, was the part where the style has to change because these guys are going to kill themselves for this company.
Hmm.
It was like we had seen this unbelievable run of work rate in the WWE. It had never been higher at this point.
Yeah.
And it was just like, okay, we need to scale things back because we are not going to have bodies to fill out cards here.
Mm-hmm.
Every guy was just – this, to me, was the peak of that point, and you saw a style change where they were forcing guys, we've got to go back to storytelling.
Yeah.
And, you know, look at a match like Michaels and Jericho that to me got over well. And how much risk was really in that match? It was
it's such a tricky thing, though, because, like, Angle, he even mentioned that, you know, for most of his career, for like 4 years at the beginning of his career, he had a completely clean bill of health. And then just somewhere along the line,
it caught up to him. Like, he's completely changed his style and has successfully, I think, reinvented himself but you look at any of his matches from 2000 through 2003.
Oh, he's doing moonsaults.
He was just killing himself in these matches with, like, upteen suplexes. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that was just, that style had to change, and this to me was the show where that was really heightened. So what were some of your thoughts on the documentary? I watched it a couple of months ago, actually, back when we were doing the Hitman documentary. I went back to watch it, just don't know why, actually. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. I think it's actually a pretty underrated documentary that people don't talk enough about, because for its time, which was 2003, 2004, there still wasn't a lot of talk of the damage that these guys go through. It really wasn't brought to the public forum until The Wrestler came out. And this documentary did a great job of hitting on those very same, very same topics.
They kind of kept the bullshit to a minimum in it. It was just...
There was no bullshit. Yeah. It was all the drama of the injuries these guys had had.
And that, to me, was the most captivating. Like, you can probably make a pretty compelling documentary for any WrestleMania, but this one in specifically, mm-hmm. with Austin's state going into this, and the cameras following him as he goes to the hospital.
Yeah.
All the stories going into this. Lesnar, Angle's neck.
Mm-hmm.
Hogan coming back to the WWE to work with Vince. You just had all these crazy stories.
Yep.
Legitimate stories that they were able to tell, and I thought they really lucked into it in that year.
It was very well done, so I highly recommend it. What do you give this show, John?
I give this show 9 out of 10.
I agree with you. I mean, they're
Miller-like girls.
Can we, I mean, like, we look at this show and there's no classic match on the show. Like, there are a lot of very good matches, but even like Angle Lesnar or Jericho and Michaels, that was a great match. But I don't know if I'd call it a classic. But however, the stories in this show itself, and just speaking on the viewing experience that I had watching this show, was tremendous. Coupled by that documentary and knowing everything that we know now today about what's here.
As I mentioned, like, just star-wise, work rate-wise, this might have been... To me, I always hold 17 right at the top,
yep.
but this is, like, right underneath it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a fantastic WrestleMania. It was at a down period for the company as, you know, the peak was over by this point. And 2003 and 4 were really, really bad years for the company. So that even speaks more to it as well of just, you know, as much as you will say about these injuries, like an incredibly driven roster here on show. Like, it's unbelievable.
And we shouldn't really, like, I mean, it's maybe sounds like we're complaining, but, like, all the respect in the world to these guys that
absolutely.
Are doing it.
I mean, I don't want to come off, like, you know, on my high horse and stuff like this. I just feel that, you know, a guy like Kurt Angle shouldn't have to be in the position where he feels he has to work this. And if you are in that position,
you
would want to know that your employer has your, that the health of your family and yourself at, you know, think of a worst case scenario where Angle takes one bad bump, which was not out of the realm of possibility, and this guy's in a wheelchair with a wife and children.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the part that I think a lot of fans at times turn off and just look at these guys as these machines that put on these four-star matches night in, night out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's just, at this point in time, I just thought it was, these expectations are unrealistic because the bar has been raised so high. So those are my thoughts. And the one other interesting note on this show, which I recall being brought up by a Law listener the night of this show after it ended, was that we saw in this show 3 leg drops by Hogan to beat Vince, 3 rock bottoms by Rock to beat Austin, and 3 F5s by Lesnar to beat Angle.
2 F5s.
No, it was 2, and then he called the audible.
Oh, you're right. Yes, yes, yes.
But 1 pedigree. So with that, everybody, we are now going to get into let's do a first interview here because I want to definitely hear from Brock Lesnar first, and then coming up later, we'll chat with David Lagana. But here's a quick snippet of our interview with Brock Lesnar. This was conducted in 2007, right before his first MMA fight with Minsoo Kim in June of 2007, where we chat about getting into pro wrestling, the match at WrestleMania 19 with Angle, and leaving the WWE.
First, I want to rewind back to 2000. You're coming out of university as an NCAA champion wrestler, and every company under the sun was making offers your way. Why the decision to go to the WWF?
Their offer was a little more outstanding than I mean, I really didn't have a whole lot of options. There was a 3-year job security, you know, basically for me, and a chance to put some money in my pocket, you know, and I thought, what the heck, I'll give it a try. And I really did enjoy it. I really enjoyed being in the ring and wrestling.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you look at the climate in mixed martial arts at that time. I mean, the UFC was nothing compared to what it is today. It was back when SEG still owned the company. And, I mean, guys were not making the type of money that a guy like you could go make in professional wrestling. So, really, I guess you didn't really have those options in MMA at the time.
Absolutely not. No, there wasn't, you know. So, I mean, it was... For me, it was either football or joining the circus.
Now, we've spoken to Kurt Angle a number of times, and he described the transition from amateur to pro wrestling as one of the most difficult transitions to make because you have to break every habit that amateur wrestling instills in you, forcing you to work with rather than against an opponent. Did you find the same difficulties transitioning over?
I would say it was just difficult to get the light bulb to go on. You know, I mean, it was just for me. Kurt picked it up real quick, and also did I. You know, so I was just I just went in with an open mind and wanted to make sure I was doing everything right. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I found everybody being very helpful, and that was, you know. Of course, you know, without people around you wanting to help you, you know, and obviously you got to want and work for it. But without being surrounded by good people, you know, it was, and I was. I went down to Louisville, and Danny Davis, the trainer down there, was, and there was a good group of guys. There was a lot of Stallions down there when I was there.
Yep.
And so we all worked together real well.
How valuable was having a guy like Jim Cornette down there in Louisville during the time where you were transitioning into wrestling? I mean, a great mind for the wrestling business. And did you feel that Cornette's influence really helped you when you graduated to the main roster?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you know, Jim was able to see talent, but he's a loose cannon. I mean, as much as he was, you know, good for the business, he was, you know, he was hard to work with, and that's why he, you know, that's why he doesn't, it's one of those things where he was very helpful and very, had a lot of ideas but as far as hands-on stuff and on promo side of it too, he was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you just never knew what kind of guy you were going to get when he came to the arena.
You were called up to the main roster in March of 2002, and they immediately paired you with Paul Heyman. How instrumental was Heyman to the overall presentation of Brock Lesnar during that period?
Well, you know, I think first and foremost, Vince seen something in me that he wanted. And for the time being, I was up doing dark matches and every day I was in the ring working before the shows and trying to learn everything I could and to pick guys that had been in the business for a long time and just to get in the ring and work out with them. And finally one day Paul and I had a discussion and I don't know how it actually, transpired, but Paul's story is, you know, he went to Vince and had an idea with it, and I think Vince just liked it, and we took off, and I was ready. I was ready to make the move.
Were you comfortable playing the heel right off the get-go?
Absolutely, yeah, because I think it's an easier, you know, it can be an easier role to play than you know, a good guy, but because to me it just kind of came more naturally, You can kind of get away with saying more things as a heel and kind of get away with working the style that you want to work as a heel. So for mm-hmm. me, I enjoyed it.
Now, you found yourself in a very unique situation early on in the company. Steve Austin had left the company at the time. The Rock was in and out making movies. And at the start of the summer, Triple H was injured. And the company turned to you with only a few months on the big stage and wanted to put the big belt on you. A lot of pressure, I imagine, for yourself during that first summer with the company in 2002.
Yeah, there, you know, to me, it just seems like one big collage. I mean, I was ready for anything that you know. Vince came to me one day and we sat in his office and had a good talk and it was just one of those things where, you know, are you ready for this? And I like responsibility and I've always been that way and so for me it was like, you know, let's go with it and here we go.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned it was all a collage, but I'm sure one night that does stick out for your memory at that time was WrestleMania 19, Safeco Field, yourself and Kurt Angle for the WWE title. Late in the match, you attempted a shooting star press, a move you had done very successfully down in Ohio Valley, down in Louisville. But this one, you landed right on your neck, and I know watching it, the first reaction I thought was, oh my God, the guy's broken his neck. What do you remember from that spot and getting to the finish, if anything?
Well, for me, first, let me state this, and it, that move wasn't my idea. That was John Laurinaitis'
idea.
Oh,
really?
And then I originally didn't want to do it. I didn't want to execute the move because I hadn't done it for a long time. And then John Laurinaitis took it to Jim Ross and to Vince, and Jim Ross said, oh, it'll be a WrestleMania moment, you know, and so I got out in the ring the night before, and I practiced it, landed it, and obviously I hadn't wrestled 20-25 minutes before that in the ropes. I'd landed the move every single time before that night, but it had been a year before I actually did the maneuver, and so I was really leery, and me and Kurt, I said, well, listen, I'll just see how it feels, and if I do it, I do it, and if I don't, I don't. Me and Kurt worked real well together, and so, I mean, it got to that point in the match, and I decided to do it, but just when I got up there, I wasn't comfortable, and my foot slipped, and I went with it, and the result. And so, you know, that move it got a lot of criticism. Well, why is he doing it, and why did he do it? And I didn't want to do it. And then I guess ultimately it was my decision in the ring, and so all the responsibility falls on my shoulders. But after that night, I suffered a concussion, and I'm very lucky I am not in a wheelchair, and after that night and after the payday that night, I thought, well, listen, I very easily could have been a quadriplegic, and all the money in the world would mean nothing, and it just wasn't worth it to me anymore.
We'll talk about your departure right now. WrestleMania 20, your matchup against Bill Goldberg. Here you are, a guy that really had busted his ass out there for 2 years. How upset were you at the reaction from the fans? Here you are, walking out on a huge contract to take a shot at the NFL. Were you pretty upset that night in Madison Square Garden?
No, I got paid, so I didn't care.
Well, that's all that really matters in the
end. You know, I mean, that's why everybody goes to work every day. You know, and I can understand that the fans were upset. You know, there's a lot of loyal fans out there, and you know, of course, everybody wants to see you keep going and doing this. But you know, I didn't let my ego get in the way of anything. It was my heart and my gut feeling and a desire to try out for the NFL.
Yeah, there's this rumor that's gone around ever since that night that Shane McMahon was in the crowd chanting "You sold out." Can you confirm that?
Oh, man, I don't know.
You'd never heard that one? That was one story that had gone around, but no one seems to be able to confirm if he was actually in the crowd. Overall, looking back at your pro wrestling career, you don't seem to regret it at all. Was it overall a very worthwhile experience for you during your time, the 4 years involved with the company?
Absolutely. I made a lot of money.
So some interesting facts there, Wei. I know Lesnar doesn't do a whole lot of interviews. That might be the only time he's spoken on record about the WrestleMania match. But John Laurinaitis, the one that came up with it, and kind of Ross that pushed for him to do it as a WrestleMania moment. Mm-hmm. And Lesnar was not super keen on doing it to begin with. But that was Brock Lesnar, everybody. And where do you want to go now, Wei?
Let's go to feedback.
All right, we're going to get into your feedback right now before we end off the show with Dave Lagana. First off, we'll start with Andy Gordon. Just finished a review of No Way Out 2003. What was WWE thinking with putting Scott Steiner in the main event since the Mania match was Triple H versus Booker T? The Rock came out to the worst theme music ever, and Hogan was the winner of the Scott Putski Award. I wish Austin would go to TNA and murder Eric just like he did on that show. TNA sucks. Could you please review the first WrestleMania?
Do you have a choice for the Scott Putski Award winner?
Oh, that's right. Well, on this show, because he worked so hard, I'm going to give Vince a pass. And I'm actually going to give it to Nathan Jones on this show.
Okay.
I thought he looked like ridiculous.
First time winner. Congratulations, Nathan Jones.
We're making
Jones.
New stars.
Dramone Jackson. Hey, guys. I'm looking forward to your WrestleMania 19 review. This Mania had possibly one of the best cards of any Mania. Even the Hogan-McMahon street fight was entertaining. I would love to hear a review of something outside of WWE and WCW, possibly the first ECW pay-per-view.
Yeah, that might be a good idea for future. This is from Sky, who attended WrestleMania. I was 16 when WrestleMania 19 took place, so I will probably have a pretty cynical look on a lot of the experience. Going back and watching, it was completely different than being in the arena. Before, I went to the Fan Fest, but all the big stars had shown up the day before, so I had to settle for Kane, Big Show, and Ray Jr. This event sucked. It was like Disneyland with all the fucking lines. Now, I know how they talk about the significance of Mania and all that crap. There was none of that when 50,000 fans are stuffed inside a baseball stadium that has a shitty team, I might add, and you put a ring in the very center. There were so many fucking people here, it was insane. I know I shouldn't knock my fellow wrestling fans, but there were some weird-ass people here. Some of them probably thought wrestling was real from the way they acted. When we, Mom and a friend, finally got to our seats, we were all the way in the corner middle deck next to the goalpost. We were pretty fucking far from the ring, and I had only been to Raws and house shows, so I was used to a very small setting that was close to the ring. This threw the whole action in the ring off. I couldn't hear a damn thing in the ring. I found myself looking at the screen a lot of the time. I don't remember the dark matches, but I do remember seeing a young John Cena come out in a WrestleMania sweatsuit. He cut a promo, which I could barely hear, and did one of the shittiest fucking raps I've ever heard in my entire life. My friend and I looked at each other with a look that pretty much was unspoken. This guy is fucking retarded. The fans were really into the opening match with Hardy and Ray, but the finish really took the wind out of the crowd. If you think wrestling doesn't change people, look at Matt and Shannon then and look at them now. Enough said. Let's redo this. The fans were really into the opening match with Hardy and Ray, but the finish really took the wind out of the crowd. If you think wrestling doesn't change people's looks, then look at... I'm taking that last sentence out. Limp Bizkit played. Big fucking deal. The Taker match was probably the worst Mania match he has ever had. My luck. One of the worst matches on the cards for sure. Funny side note, there were some college kids who showed up. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, let's chop this up.
Jesus Christ, I didn't realize.
Okay, there were some college kids who showed up drunk, and they were pretty entertaining. One guy was so drunk he had put his female friend's pink thong on. Yeah, you read that right. He ended up passing out halfway through.
Great. Shawn and Jericho was probably the best match of the night. Crowd was really into the match. We're not going to be able to get to all of this, Sky. The stadium was freezing. This sucked. Hogan-Vince match might have looked great on TV, but live it was terrible. I saw Hogan give Vince one of the weakest chair shots I've ever seen. It didn't come across weak. Piper got a huge pop, and now I think of it, Hogan's entrance was pretty intense. Most surreal experience was Austin coming out. Main event was awesome.
Okay.
Fireworks went off, we left, which took forever when 50,000 people try and exit the building at once. Biggest complaint, too many people. And you know what, Sky? We'll post your entire message on the law update Monday. I will put this whole thing up there so people can go back, because it's a very detailed report. We just don't have time, unfortunately.
We got Matthew Burrell next. My most memorable moment of Mania 19 is Tori Wilson somehow knowing so little about pro wrestling that she thinks Hulk Hogan invented WrestleMania. My question for Mr. Pollock and Mr. Ting is this. With such a solid card and such great matches, which matches do you think were the worst and the best? To me, the worst was the Undertaker match, and the best was Austin and Rock. Though I could definitely see someone saying Jericho HBK was better. Brock being dazed for the last part of his match takes a lot away from it, for me. I just wish that we could get one more Mania in Seattle, especially since Florida is getting another one, and they have the worst wrestling crowds, bar none. My favorite match, I think it was Jericho and HBK from a technical standpoint, but just from a interest standpoint, I would pick any of the last two matches, maybe even the last one, just because of so much happening.
Yeah, and I personally didn't feel the Shooting Star botch killed the match.
I
thought the way they reacted to it was unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
It definitely wasn't a perfect match by any means, but as a match that we can reflect on and discuss about, absolutely.
Ciaran Highland. 19 was the first WrestleMania I didn't watch live on Sky Sports since X7 when I started watching wrestling in late 2000 when I was 12. I bought the DVD eventually, though, and really enjoyed it. Shawn versus Jericho stole the show. Austin versus Rock was a worthy conclusion to their rivalry and a great way for Austin to retire. Lesnar versus Angle was incredible considering how injured Angle was. Even Hogan and McMahon was surprisingly fun. Booker T versus Triple H was only okay, though. I really thought Booker T deserved to win. He finally hit his stride in WWE, was really over, and would have made a fresh face as world champion. Currently been listening to the earlier review of Ways. They are all great, but exposed. Pro Wrestling's Greatest Secrets is one of my particular favorites. You guys flipping out when you realized the recording didn't work properly made that show.
Yes, Rem Nasralla. Hey, Wayne, John. Another great review, and WrestleMania 19 is going to be great. I remember you just being pissed that Booker T didn't win the title. After that racist program with Triple H. Two things. How do the WWE or others punish their wrestlers when they screw up like today? I don't recall them having a situation like R-Truth where he gets pinned in a matter of seconds, or is that just me? I recall when Warrior got laid out by Owen, Bulldog, and Vader, but that wasn't as bad as what they do to wrestlers these days. Second thing, I was out at a new club here called Voodoo, and what did they use as a logo? Papa Shango. He told me, he talked to a bouncer, and he told me that I asked him about Papa Shango, and he replied, "Nah, I didn't know it was a pro wrestler. I just wanted a juiced-up voodoo man on the posters."
Okay. Well, that's great. Burying guys because of incidents have gone back forever. So it's not unique to just this generation or R-Truth. Papa Shango's, everybody. Go check out Voodoo.
In Denmark.
In Denmark, if you're in the area. Davey Ziegler. You don't want Rock on Raw too much because you think it will hurt WrestleMania buys? What are you, a stockholder or something? Raw will be more entertaining with him on the show. Why be so worried about Vince's pocketbook? And then why don't you read the one he sent us the next day?
The very next day, Davey says, I can see now your point of keeping Rock off Raw to keep him special for Mania, as that promo last night wasn't very good. Though I guess it will look good in comparison to that dreadful Cena segment. I've heard polarizing
thoughts on this promo, but I
enjoyed it.
I loved it. I had a very genuine mark out moment for that promo. And it's just interesting to see the differences of opinion.
I'm going to skip a few down here because we're not going to be able to get to all of these. Let's Kurt Morales. John and Way are dicks for spoiling the TNA title change on TNA next week. Why the fuck would you do that? It's like telling everybody the ending to a film. First of all, I was overjoyed when I saw this comment to know that people still care about the TNA title. Because, and I'm not even saying that sarcastically. Mm-hmm. I genuinely mean it, that people still care to that degree that a spoiler ruined it. And for that, we apologize. But
sure.
At the same time, we're covering a show where we are describing events that have already occurred. And, you know, we did say this is a spoiler alert.
My whole thinking behind that was that going on any of the Facebook groups, going on our own Facebook group or the Lost Facebook group, this was clearly the topic of discussion from everybody. And so for us to ignore it, it really would have just made us look stupid. But, I understand people, like Jay Hunter pointed out later on in this thread, that we didn't actually talk that much about the title change, which was not my intent. I guess I was hoping to talk more about it. There's just, I guess, not that much to say. Mm-hmm. Sting won the title.
So, I don't know.
We'll be more careful in the future, fine.
I don't know. Personally, for me, I've never had a problem with knowing stuff ahead of time. That's never affected my enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's like I can read one thing, and then more than anything, I want to see how it comes off. Like, we have not seen this, whatever we're talking about. You hadn't seen it at that point, and see how it comes off. Maybe it's great, maybe it's shit. But
I can understand. I can understand both.
Anyway.
Ahmad, but someone else posted this, but I really think you guys should stop reviewing TNA Impact. This latest episode was so depressing. I could hear the despair and pain in your voices.
We're alive, everybody. We'll make it through. Reed Dubar, I wish you guys would post your podcasts for Impact on the TNA Facebook sites. All TNA sheep need to listen to your correct reviews of a bad, bad wrestling show. Well, we should do that, and I encourage all of you who listen to spread the word around. Just take the link and post it like whores. We encourage it.
If you like it, share it with people.
Yes.
Please. Let's go to Stephen Smith. I thought Dave Wills was actually a really good guest, which was a surprise because I'd expected I'd hate him, but I found him really interesting. If I was in his shoes and found out that an embarrassing video of me had been uploaded to YouTube and gone viral, I'd have been pretty pissed off. So I have nothing but praise for his ability to shrug it off and take it in stride.
Very cool. And finally, Matthew Tremblay, why does every time I see the logo of Review a Raw or Review an Impact, I instantly think about the long-awaited battle between John Cena and Tajiri instead of John Pollock and Wei Ting doing a podcast?
Huh. Well, I don't know.
Me neither. John Cena and Tajiri.
Don't know why you think that.
You're a much better worker than me.
You're a much better rapper than me.
Oh yeah, we had the big one about Undertaker here.
Oh god.
I'll go through this really quickly.
No, it's fine.
John Bondragon from Quebec writes into us. You and Way were wondering what it was all about, and I doubt that a lot of your listeners know this. He's talking about the Undertaker's finish, the TCB he used at No Way Out that we reviewed last week in 2003. It has nothing to do with the song Taking Care of Business. I was being sarcastic about that. It's a term that the Hell's Angels use when they resolve issues internally, which is often the murder of a member. They wear the TCB patches on the vest, along with other symbols like the 1%. That means they are part of the 1% of bikers that are involved in criminal activities. I don't know if Mark Calloway is in the gang. I always heard he was close to them, and clearly he idolizes them. During his biker taker gimmick, he often would wear a Big Red Machine shirt, and Big Red Machine is a term that refers to the Hell's Angels, not Kane.
Huh. And he continues, the thing that really upset me was when he wore a Support the Nomad Crew shirt several times on TV. The Nomads were a chapter of the gang, and they were the most violent elite shock troops the Hell's Angels ever had. They were located in Montreal, and that's where he first showed up with that shirt in a WWE ring of all places. Like, he didn't care about the innocent victims that had died in the shootouts and bombings in Quebec from the mid-90s till the early 2000s, and didn't care about the local crowd and population who had to endure this crap for a decade. We're talking kid getting blown up by mistake in the street, crime journalists getting shot, police and prison guards getting shot, random people getting beaten up because they looked at them the wrong way, bar owner forced into letting them sell drugs in the bar, podheads forced to buy from them because they took control of everything, local small-time drug dealers getting shot and beaten, etc., without even talking about the hundreds of murders from the biker feuds between the Hells Angels and Rock Machines, and afterwards the Bandidos gang. Everyone in Quebec hated and feared them at the same time. They were bigger and way more arrogant than the mafia. The police had raided the Hells Angels bunkers slash safe houses all over Quebec and had arrested a lot of them, including the boss Maurice Mom Boucher. And this clown shows up here a few days after, seemingly unaware of how insane these guys were. So as a face wrestler, it made absolutely no sense for Taker to wear that shirt in Montreal. I love the Taker character because I was a kid, but lost all respect for the man on that day because he was basically urging us fans to support his murderous friends that lived in my province. I thought, hey, fuck you, dumbass. Stop romanticizing them that they are cold-blooded mass murderers, not cool rebels. I even wrote a very polite complaint to WWE asking them to stop this support. I didn't get a response, and he wore the Nomad shirt several more times that year. So yeah, the TCB move is basically a way to say, I will murder you with this move. Sorry for making this long and sending it to your email, but I thought you should know this info. Thank you very much for giving us all this context.
We had zero idea about the references there for
TCB. Wow. I didn't know any of that. So that's the type of feedback we love the most.
Yeah, when stuff you can, that you would absolutely have no clue about in terms of the Montreal gang scene. My voice is nearly shot right now. I feel like Michael Cole. So we will... We're going to end things off, everybody, because the show's not done yet, because joining us now on the line is former WWE creative member David Lagana, joining us all the way from L.A.
We just reviewed WrestleMania 19, one of the most noteworthy WrestleManias, I think, in my opinion, with so much stuff going on behind the scenes in the lead-up to this show. Who better to bring back than Mr. Lagana? And Dave, you have been one busy man over the last little while, building a bit of an empire online with IWantWrestling.com.
Building it from the living room I have no furniture in, it's quite the empire made of popsicle sticks. So it's lovely. My castle made of popsicle sticks. So.
And it seems that this week there seems to be competition with the I Want Wrestling hashtag with one Charlie Sheen now introducing winning. But I still feel that I Want Wrestling is still the most influential hashtag going right now in our neck of the woods.
Sherman Oaks, California is, I guess, becoming the social media battleground. You know, it's funny, Charlie posted that picture from the hot dog stand. I don't know if you guys saw that, where it was like winning dog or the Charlie dog or whatever it was. That stand is like a block from my mailbox. So it's my official mailing address here in California. So, you know, Charlie's got some much better house guests than mine. He's got a couple of lovely ladies. If you don't follow one of them on Twitter, I suggest highly she is. Highly entertaining. I'll just leave it at that.
What better way to move over to a WrestleMania 19 than Charlie Sheen? But let's first set the table here, Dave, because a lot was going on here behind the scenes. It was the previous month that Paul Heyman was kind of taken out of the lead writer's spot, and that put you into that position, I believe, working with Bruce Pritchard. Is that how things kind of turned out with that whole shuffling backstage?
Yeah, that was. I had been in the company 1 year at that point. Literally, I think day and date from when Paul was sent home the first time. That was like 1 year in the company, and it was kind of like, you know, all right, you're in charge. I'm like, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, Bruce. Oh, okay. So I'm in charge. So, you know, Bruce is really good at producing stuff, but you know, self-admittedly, he'll say, you know, he likes to mess with stuff once it's kind of there. So a lot of the creative was kind of thrown in my lap. And at the time, I think I was still 26 years old, or I was 27. And, you know, having discussions with The Undertaker about his WrestleMania program was a wee bit intimidating.
Now, for those that, I mean, they know, you know, the terms of being on the creative team, when you graduate and become the lead writer on the show, what specific responsibilities were you tasked with in addition to your regular duties? I mean, tell us a bit about kind of the totem pole system in the WWE when you become the lead writer and what that entails.
Yeah, and at the time that this all happened, this was, this was that, that tumultuous year of 2002 was kind of the year that 2002-2003, that calendar, you know, the 365 days from when I started to when I took over as head of SmackDown, the writing teams were split. So before, it used to be one team writing both shows, and the brands split, and the teams were split in two, which they still exist split to this day, almost 9 years, oh, 9 years later. So I was, you know, under Paul Heyman, and then when Paul got the vacation, I ended up having to be in charge of everything from soup to nuts. You know, it was, you know, when you're the head writer, you're in charge of setting the ideas that get pitched to Vince, you know, setting the shows. And one of the very first things I did was kind of, I saw how the system was and I didn't like it as far as pitching to Vince. We like the, and it's apparently gone back to this way as well, you know, where you just collect a bunch of ideas that you would pitch him, not with really kind of a stream of consciousness. This is how I see the movie from A to Z. So one of the first things I did was create, all right, well, I'm going to walk in with a full show. Now, I'll have backups in my back pocket and different pitches, but the pitch that he was sent was always the very, what we believed was the best show possible, and a fully written show on a Thursday or Friday whenever we met with him. So that kind of was my duties and something that I would try and bring in some planning. I introduced the famed grids that, you know, we all kind of ended up hating, and I think people despise me for, as far as long-term planning. You know, okay, here's the one show we want to do, and here's the 4 weeks for that story we want to do from here on out till WrestleMania. And that all kind of started in this one period in February of 2003.
Now, Dave, you talk about that period on SmackDown right after the brand split, and there's a real noticeable difference between the two shows almost right off the bat in terms of quality of matches. I mean, on the Raw side, we had things like Katie Vick and Scott Steiner, whereas on SmackDown, this era was probably, aside from maybe Brock Lesnar, really defined by the era of the SmackDown 6. Was this a deliberate decision to give guys that could work the pull, or was it just something that was coincidental?
No, SmackDown's always kind of had that same chemistry, and it was kind of the SmackDown has always been the B show, as far as being not as far as quality, but as far as attention. You know, Monday's first, Monday's live. Monday's the show you can tinker with as far as live. SmackDown's always been that tape show that has days to be edited. And, you know, it's kind of like you run a marathon on Monday. Oh, you're not going to want to run as hard on Tuesday. And sometimes they do a raw quality show or raw style show on a Tuesday. But, you know, and Paul and I agree on a lot of philosophies when it comes to talent. And if you look at the talent moves of 2002, you know, getting Brock Lesnar exclusive, he was a raw talent. And, you know, we saw the kind of the tea leaves, and Paul obviously managing him kind of helped. So getting Brock Lesnar as a SmackDown exclusive talent was important. The trades and drafting of that July period, I think if you go back and look, I think we traded the Un-Americans and Chris Jericho and got back Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit. I think there may have been some other talents as well. I think we got Crash Holly as well. But, you know, there were some, you know, the talent moves allowed kind of that, as you said, quote-unquote SmackDown 6. You know, and the, you know, the laying out of that first tag team tournament featured all of them prominently. You know, it was the Guerreros, Edge and Rey Mysterio and Benoit and Kurt Angle. That was like, those were the guys that kind of were having the great tag team matches. And I remember Edge and Rey versus Benoit and Angle for the tag team titles was a spectacular, you know, finals. I think it was the finals for those tag team titles.
Yeah.
Just put the Guerreros in there. And then you added Team Angle. You know, it was a lot of really strong, good characters tied in there as well. And, you know, that was probably a favorite period. And also the same time period that John Cena was launched. And kind of, if you said prototype, how would you build a wrestling, you know, roster and time period company-wise? You had Brock Lesnar, The Undertaker, Big Show on top at the time. You had all the SmackDown 6 doing tag team stuff. And you had characters like John Cena, you know, ascending underneath that. That to me is eye on the big time. Eye on the mid-card, and mid-card is status, but as far as entertaining matches that get people excited, and you had an eye on the future.
Now, what was kind of the dynamic like? Because Paul Heyman was still on the road, appearing as a talent on screen at the time. Was he still in the room for creative meetings? And as well, how did you find that you gelled with Bruce Pritchard at that time?
Paul, I mean, it was kind of a very much a clean split. Paul is still a talent. You know, obviously I had my personal relationship with Paul, still do to this day. You know, it was hard because this was kind of the, you know, I'd worked with Paul for a year and, you know, your friendships grow over time. So, you know, he was very, I think, upset at the time. I mean, I remember him and I having some nice words that day in Montreal that we talked about years later, kind of, you know, he wasn't sure what had happened at the time. And so, you know, it was a difficult time for Paul, which I'm sure will be in his upcoming book, which I'm looking forward to reading as well as everybody. But, you know, Bruce is a much different style. And you know, Bruce has his detractors as much as he has his, you know, protractors. Is that a word? You know, people that like working with Bruce. I got along with Bruce because Bruce allowed me a lot of freedom to kind of learn the job on the fly and also be my support system. He dealt with Taker a lot, gave me a lot of very hard conversations that, you know, Taker looks at a new guy and goes, why am I going to listen to this guy? And, you know, dealt with a lot of higher level talent that I wasn't really comfortable with. You know, think about it. I was in the business, quote unquote, for a year, and now I was in charge of the number two wrestling show on television. It was a hard kind of jump for me. And at the time, I was the new guy on the team. There were people far more experienced in the team that didn't get the opportunity, and, you know, and I had to work really hard to keep it.
Let's talk a bit about the build for WrestleMania. Obviously, SmackDown, they were presenting Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, and then you also had the return of Hulk Hogan paired with Vince McMahon, which kind of got the push as the main event heading into the show. Tell us a bit about these two very distinct feuds that you guys were presenting on SmackDown, and was there a big discussion on how to handle Hulk Hogan coming back here and what his proper role would be at that time?
I mean, the Hogan-Vince match was kind of the most set of the stuff, you know, and I honestly think, because at WrestleMania, if you go back and look in history, did not do a great buy rate.
No.
I think the pay-per-view before, I know you guys already reviewed it, the No Way Out, I think, you know, going back now, they wouldn't make this mistake now. You know, for that No Way Out pay-per-view, they brought back Rock, they brought back Hogan, they brought back Steve.
Yeah.
A month before WrestleMania. And it did a great buy rate, but now WrestleMania was coming around, and what was special for that WrestleMania? It was all the same guys coming back for rematches. And they brought Goldberg in for the pay-per-view after. So there was nothing special for that WrestleMania per se. You know, Hogan Rock being the rematch of the great WrestleMania match, to me, should have been the was at that WrestleMania. You know what I mean? Because Hogan's Rock Steve was good, but I felt like, you know, if you had to pick one, I think that rematch might have had a little bit more cachet at that WrestleMania. But anyways, Rock worked with Steve that year, and Hogan and Vince was a great match and was the kickoff to what was going to be a really long program. But Vince and Hogan was a great story because, and if you go back and watch those videos, and I think the one that's special that aired before, it was a very real story. And, you know, I think it's an interesting one now, especially because they're back quibbing at each other. You know, it was kind of an interesting story to tell, and there wasn't much in the way of angles. You know, Vince screwed Hogan in Montreal, just like he screwed Brett in that match, although it was a much different type of screwdriver that, you know, everyone's just kind of tired of that anyway, but that kind of was the angle. And then there was a lot of promos after that, and I don't really remember much beyond that. It was kind of the big fight feel and the story of guys who were best friends who made WrestleMania, and they were going to settle it. The match itself was one of my favorites. I mean, because it still has my number one favorite visual, probably, I don't know in the history, but as Vince comes up over the apron with that face of blood, with, I think, he had the crowbar in his head, there's no more sinister look than I've ever seen in pro wrestling than that one of Vince McMahon. So that was a really good one. And then on the Brock Lesnar-Kurt Angle match, that match almost didn't happen. I assume it was out there. I don't really remember, but Kurt Angle was having neck problems at the time. And this is before he had the very experimental surgery with Dr. Joe. Because he was given the, you know, I remember at that time, Edge had gone off and gotten the one-year surgery. It's kind of the Tommy John surgery of pro wrestling, you know, the Austin surgery, the neck fusion with that option. And he wasn't going to make WrestleMania. So if you go back and look in the history, there was that Pittsburgh SmackDown that was originally going to be where Brock was going to win the title and he was going to end up working with Benoit at that WrestleMania. And so this came a point where Kurt said, you know what, I'm going to do the match. I want to get the smaller surgery, you know, the Dr. Joe surgeries that came to be known. and we did it, but we had already announced the title match in Pittsburgh. So we did the switch with Kurt's brother, Eric. And you know, which you kind of look back on it in a moment of, I think, hotshot booking, the idea that Kurt Angle beat Brock Lesnar in under a minute, you know, was not probably the best way to, you know, build a WrestleMania match. But going into WrestleMania, I think they ended up having a blowaway match that had, of course, had the ending of the Shooting Star Press gone awry. But even that, I think that even added to the, you know, and thankfully Brock was okay, but that added to the legend of that match now. And all of this was kind of stamped even further by the great documentary that Chris Chambers and Heather Mitchell produced for WWE. This is the Mania Behind Mania, which is, if someone said to me, what is it like to work at WWE, I'd tell you to watch that video first.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dave, you've talked about all the drama behind the Lesnar Angle build beforehand. How nervous was the company in putting Kurt Angle, this man who was practically risking paralysis, into the main event of the biggest show of the year?
I mean, I remember the phone call, you know, that Kurt wasn't going to do it, and the choice was in Kurt's hand. You know what I mean? Vince didn't say, you have to do it. You know, he always kind of, in a situation like that, it's in the talent's hands to make the right decision for their bodies. So, you know, once he made the decision and felt like he could, you know, and that's why I direct people to the documentary, because Kurt and Brock talk about it very heavily there, so I don't want to speak for them. But it was definitely, it added a level, and if you remember, Kurt was really a babyface to the audience, because the audience knew that he was, quote-unquote, wrestling with a broken neck, you know, and he wasn't as much the bad guy in that match as probably should have been, you know, to kind of make this new era of Brock Lesnar. You know, this was Brock's defining babyface moment, where he was finally getting the title back out that he was screwed of. But, you know, it was a match I think we all kind of sat on the edge of our seats watching.
Yeah, I know myself, knowing all the issues going into that match, I mean, you watch that match with such a different feeling than, you know, any other match on that card, knowing the actual circumstances that were going on. And the documentary really captured some incredible stories within that entire production, two of which were the post-match effects on both Lesnar, who suffered that concussion, and Angle basically going into, you know, post-stress, essentially, with all the come-down from that match. It was unbelievable to see that footage and what happened after the match backstage with those two.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was one of those, and that one thing that isn't shown, the kind of, and it sort of is, we just see the guys getting on golf carts where the, and I'm trying to remember this properly, I think where the locker rooms were on the third base side. It was, or it was in the outfield. Because I remember the in the documentary, you see it was either Austin or Brock went down a set of steps into a clubhouse or into this thing. That was in the outfield. Or maybe it was third base. I don't remember. Maybe the entranceway was in the outfield. So, yeah, that's right. It was the locker rooms on the third base side. So to get to the entranceway, you had to walk from third base, you know, back around home plate, up first base, into the outfield. It was about a 15-minute walk or a 10-minute walk to get to Gorilla. So it was that, you know, Brock, the scene with Brock, you know what I mean? He's trying to be tended to, and Kurt went to the locker room, which was on the third base side. It was just this scope of, you know, everybody was so spread out. I remember walking with Vince to Gorilla because he wanted to walk for some reason. And, you know, it just was this really interesting environment, you know what I mean? Because everything was so spread out. It was such a big show. It is really kind of my favorite WrestleMania for everything that kind of went on. And just if you go back and look at what the company kind of was, everyone kind of looks at the WrestleMania 2 years earlier at the peak of the company. This was kind of the last gasp of the Attitude Era on WrestleMania. Because after that, it then became the, you know, Benoit and Eddie era and then the Cena era. But this WrestleMania was kind of that last grasp to everything that kind of worked in the 90s.
I know, you know, everyone is under the same umbrella, but I've got to imagine that it was a big source of pride for you guys having Lesnar and Angle close out the show. And as well, you compare it to the Raw end where the title program with Triple H and Booker T, which was a program that was marred with a lot of stuff that just didn't connect with the audience. The crowd did not respond in Seattle to the match. And it was really, and then you had Hogan and Vince follow those two. And I thought those two, for all their limitations, just worked incredibly hard, and I thought brought the crowd right back into things. I thought the Raw title match was really a disappointment on that show.
Yeah, and I don't remember everything from that, and, you know, and I don't want to speak for Triple H. I don't assume that was what he enjoyed most about having, you know, the hip placement on that show. You know, and then if you look following that, he ended up closing the next three WrestleManias.
Yeah, that's true.
With Benoit and Shawn, and had three remarkable, you know, pay-per-view WrestleMania-type moments as far as the match with Benoit and Shawn. The one with Cena, which is, you know, as far as crowd reactions and big fight feels, one of my favorites.
Yeah, we were at that WrestleMania. Yeah, that was incredible live for that.
The Chicago one was like, you know, and I know I was in a different place in my life, but just being in the crowd to watch how that was, you know, and it's funny, the crowd now sort of still in that way with Cena, but that was almost 5 years ago, if you think about it. It was 5 years ago. And, you know, like, how different the crowd reacts now to Cena from when he had started, it was just really good. So, you know, everyone doesn't have a great WrestleMania every year. You know what I mean? So Triple H to not be in a position that, you know, is memorable. It was, I mean, that WrestleMania was Jericho and Shawn. You know what I mean? That was the first time they had fought. It was Rey Mysterio's first WrestleMania. You know, that there was a lot on that WrestleMania. It also, I mean, that was probably the last year that Taker didn't have a great WrestleMania. You know what I mean? Because he was in that weird handicap match with A-Train and Big Show. You know what I mean? Like, so everybody doesn't always have the quote-unquote WrestleMania moments. I don't feel like Cena's had one. You know, last year Batista was good, but he hasn't had one, as far as I'm concerned, since the match with Shawn in Detroit. So no. Hopefully this year will be it for him.
Now, Dave, I know you're in charge of the SmackDown side of things, but on the Raw side, when talking about that Triple H Booker T angle, you do have to mention, you know, the infamous racist connotation promo that Triple H delivered in that build. Was the plan always for Booker to lose at Mania?
I don't remember off the top of my head. What followed that? 25 years of wrestling in my head. I'm trying to think they did that weird six man the next month too. I don't remember.
Yeah, they did
exactly
that.
What was supposed to happen?
It was basically because they went to Rock Goldberg, and kind of the Raw title was just kind of on hold for the next pay per view, and then I think it went to Hunter and Nash for a little bit for a pay per view or two.
Oh, that's right. And then they went to the Hell in the Cell. That was when Mick finally came back to the company and all that stuff. So I don't remember everything. I honestly don't remember much about that program. And again, remember, this was me being thrown into a job that I wasn't qualified for, honestly. You know, so a lot of my energy and memories are kind of scarred by the beating that I got early on in that job. So.
Did you have your hand in some of the Raw storylines, or was it primarily just SmackDown that you were focused on at the time? And just
I think I had to be. You know, I mean, I was trying to keep my head above water with SmackDown. You know, because I figured I'd get pulled out of the job within 6 weeks. I honestly did. I didn't think. You know what I mean? I figured. And this happened too when Paul was taken off ECW. I didn't want it. You know what I mean? Like I like leading at times, but you know, being thrown in charge of something that I didn't feel like I was qualified for, but ended up doing, I believe, a decent or a good job with. I'm sure I had my critics, but you know, that time period. Because if you remember, after that WrestleMania, we did a lot of experimental, so I'll just say that, with characters like Zach Gowen and Mr. America. And stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't remember anything. Like, I just had to think about what was on that Raw stuff after that. I don't really remember much of the creation of that story. So I wish I could, but I don't have much memory of that.
Just before we wrap up on this chat, I also just wanted to get some of your thoughts, because coming out of WrestleMania, they brought back Sable, they brought back Roddy Piper, and there seemed to be a big emphasis on kind of bringing back stars from the past. Was kind of the mindset to try and get kind of focus that star power and transfer it, or was it almost a panic reaction to some of the newer talent not getting over? What was kind of the thought process on bringing back some of those names?
I'm trying to remember what was the catalyst to Sable. I think it was just kind of like one of those.
That was the one that shocked everybody, considering the lawsuit, and that was one I think no one thought that Sable and WWE would get back together at that time.
Yeah, and that was Tori was on the cover of Playboy, and they brought Sable back. she kicked her, and it was like, okay, interesting. I don't know. I don't know what led to it. I just knew it was kind of. In some days, it would be. It's like the Vince Russo guys. I've brought Vince Russo back. He's
yeah.
today. okay, you know, you didn't have much time to react. You just had, or you had to. And so, and the same with Roddy. Roddy was brought back as a spot for that WrestleMania match. Wouldn't it be great if Hogan's greatest rival got involved in the match? And no one really knew. I don't think I even knew until 2 days before or a day before. I mean, he wasn't at any of the WrestleMania stuff. And this was the last WrestleMania they didn't have a Hall of Fame before, mm-hmm. too. So it was just still just the event. I mean, there was access and stuff. And that was the Seattle WrestleMania. That was one of my favorites because it was, you know, Seattle was such a fun town to be in. And I will give a tour recommendation if you ever want to explore a really cool town. Not that Toronto isn't lovely, but I would say Seattle is one of my favorite places. Because there's just a lot to do, and it's just a very pretty town with a lot of good stuff to do. But anyway, so Roddy just kind of appeared, and, you know, it ended up, I don't think he was on the next day, but then we promoted the return of Piper's Pit, which was the first time he had done it, you know, since then. Which I think Vince maybe was his first guest, and then we did the coconut thing, and then he had Sean O'Hare. There was a lot of weird, like I said, there was a lot of experimental stuff, but again, that WrestleMania was kind of, to me, the true end of the ad. You know, it kind of stuck around with Hogan and stuff, but once that WrestleMania was over, I feel like the Attitude Era was finally kind of put to rest, and the new generation of the John Cena generation, which we're in now, kind of really was started. And if you remember, that WrestleMania build had the building up of John Cena, basically the genesis of the real John Cena character when he was cutting those promos on Brock. Ended up working with Brock at that next WrestleMania, the next pay-per-view, and kind of was the launching point of him. He did a rap that I got in a wee bit of trouble for before WrestleMania on Heat, where he used such terms as mangina, and I think it was the first XFL joke that was, which I cleared the XFL joke, but I did not clear the mangina line, which I got a little bit of discussion. This was Vince having discussion before his match going, what the hell was that? I'm like, sorry, you want him to be edgy, you know what I mean? Like, so, yeah.
Well, and you bring up John Cena there, and that's kind of where I wanted to end off, because a lot of people have been very critical of the promo this past week involving Alex Riley, The Miz, and Cena, and I wanted to get your first-hand account of kind of the Brian Gerwitz effect of where you're building up. I think there's definitely a role for comedy within pro wrestling. I think it's necessary in some aspects, but I find that when it comes to a main event program, especially for WrestleMania, I find like the comedy in that segment to me just, it took out so much air from that program. And just tell us a bit about the mindset within the creative process of this constant need to inject comedy where at times I don't feel it's needed at all.
Well, and I think, you know, as much as people point fingers at Brian, it also has to be to the talent, and John's performing it, and John's done enough stroke in that company that basically if he doesn't like a talent, that talent doesn't work there, that talent doesn't get pushed. So to me, if John didn't want to do that performance, you know, or do certain material, he wouldn't do it. So it falls on John, and this is probably the most critical part of John's career since 2003, as far as I'm concerned, because he now, and I'm sure I can be disproven wrong, he now has been on top for 5 years, 6 years, the top guy in that company, which is double the time of Rock or Austin. I think combined, those two were on top for about 5 years, honestly, as far as amount of time. Hogan, I think, was 6 years as well, from maybe seven, from 84 to 91, really kind of on top fully with that company full time. So, you know, he's approaching kind of an audience thing. It's actually something cheap plug of the day. I just had a MIT professor who wrote a book about soap operas and pro wrestling, talking about, you know, long time characters on shows, and there gets to be a point where the audience just goes, I've seen enough, you know what I mean, with a character, or the character needs to kind of kick into a change. And John's character is at this really interesting crossroads where he's going head to head with the greatest promo in the history of the business and who is knocking it out of the park. He needs to be knocking out of the park every week. And the Riley thing, to me, violated a couple of things. It kind of made Miz, standing there with the title, he was ripping on his number two. It'd be the equivalent of me ripping on Way here and you not standing up for him, John. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, you would have to stand up for him. And Miz just stood there. And he let him put his hand on him. And, you know, there's certain positioning. I mean, Miz is already kind of behind the eight ball, being the third most famous guy in this match.
Yeah.
And Miz is cutting great promos to me. You know, Miz is second in this program. You know what I mean, as far as cutting promos. So John's material, I think, is on John and is on whoever's writing it. I'm assuming it's Brian, as far as what they really want. What's going to make John Cena stand out? Because he, at the end of this period, on April, whatever, the day after WrestleMania, April 4th or April 5th, what are people going to, are they going to see John Cena differently? Did he go toe-to-toe with The Rock? Otherwise, he will always be secondary to The Rock. And if that's what he's going to be, and that's what he's going to end up being, but he has a chance to really blow The Rock out of the water. Because he is there live. You know what I mean? Like I'm there live, and this is what you're giving me? I want the guy on tape. You know what I mean?
I completely agree with that, and I just you just don't want to really cloud the issue, I think, with and deviate off. It's kind of easy for, you know, come up with some clever lines, but kind of keep the focus of this main event program. Before we end off here, Dave, tell us about iwantwrestling.com. You're doing a lot of cool stuff on there and getting tons of response to it. So tell listeners where they can go check out more of your work.
Yeah, it started, I think, just literally less than 2 months ago. You know, it started almost as an idea, as a promotional tactic for Ring of Honor for the TV show, and ended up becoming this, I hate the term movement, but it's a chance for everyone to kind of speak out with what they want. And the nice thing is everybody wants something different from pro wrestling. What I want is different than what John wants. It's different what he wants. It's different than anyone listening to this wants. But the great thing that is now in our hands is now we all have a voice. Twitter has really kind of opened up this giant giant space for us all to speak with what we want. And it's up to us to build our own audiences as far as who's listening to us. And I mentioned this in another podcast I just recorded. I would assume that people at WWE have a search, you know, going on during live Raws for live feedback. And now they've even outrated Nielsen. Now it's important when things trend. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? As far as The Rock trending for this and how many followers get added and all this stuff. That's important. That's another measurable effect of the impact of an angle. And what it to me is just another way to get in the conversation. And that's all I really have tried to create with the hashtag I Want Wrestling. That's in the conversation. I didn't get the chance to watch Impact. I was out having sushi with a good friend. And I came home and clicked the hashtag and just saw people using it. And that, to me, just shows I really want to start the conversation and let everyone speak to what they want. So the site is full of that. I write some blogs every once in a while. We launched a podcast 3 weeks ago, which started with one, you know, writer's podcast. And I added a press podcast, which I want to have you guys on. And then today I launched another one called 15 Minutes, which I'm looking for the most passionate and unique wrestling voices out there. If you want to be able to speak wrestling 15 minutes, I'll set it literally a countdown clock and we'll talk wrestling for 15 minutes. And if you want to do that, go to facebook.com/iwantwrestling, write on the wall and tell me why I should talk wrestling with you. If you write it, it's just like a great wrestling promo. If you write to me a okay kind of statement of why I should, I'm probably not going to pick you. I'm looking for people that I can have great wrestling discussion with and have a reason that your voice needs to be heard. What are you going to bring to the table that's different than everybody else? And that's what I'm trying to do, is create unique voices in the business that are open. You know what I mean? There's no telling you you're wrong. It's simply, what do you want out of wrestling? And you'll find it. And you'll find it at iwantwrestling.com.
So that is where we direct everyone to go, and I definitely encourage you all to check it out. The Formerly Creative podcast definitely contains the best sign-off of any wrestling podcast I have ever heard, and you'll have to download it to hear. So we'll leave them with a tease. No. Send them to the podcast, Dave.
I'll do it right now. I don't care, because it's the anchor around creative's neck is, you know, anytime a talent is released, they get a phone call and they go, "Oh, I'm sorry, man. I did everything I could, but creative has nothing for you." That's my good friend John Laurinaitis, who never called me after I was let go from the company. I didn't even get a wish the best of luck in my future endeavors by Johnny. But it's okay. He's still making a lot more money than I ever did. So now the sign off to the podcast now is, unlike what John Laurinaitis tells you, creative always has something for you. And that's true. Nine times out of ten, you know, a decision was made by talent relations and high-ups in the company of a talent, quote-unquote, not getting it. And, you know, our job as creative was to come up with ideas for everybody. You know, if there was a talent that had been in the company for 15 years and, you know, had we exhausted everything, sure, we wouldn't have anything for them. But my job was to come up with ideas for everyone, from Funaki to this person. You know what I mean? So creative always has something for somebody. If you're a creative person, you can come up with an idea for anybody.
Well, Dave, I want to thank you again for sitting down and chat with us. You always add so much to these shows and taking our listeners kind of behind the scenes of these events they watch. So it's always great to have you on. And unlike John Laurinaitis, me and Wei are always wishing you the best in all of your many future endeavors.
Awesome. I look forward to more endeavoring your futures.
So thank you very much, Mr. Lagana. And you can check out his website, iwantwrestling.com. He's doing tons of podcasts up there with former WWE creative members, as well as members of the media, wrestling media on there as well.
I really enjoy his site. The audio he's putting up is excellent.
As I said in the interview, the most well-known hashtag right now, I want wrestling.
I completely disagree. Winning is the most well-known hashtag.
Is it?
Of course. Charlie Sheen had 1 million followers in one day.
Wow. That's pretty intense.
It's insane.
And that brings us to an end of a very lengthy edition of Review Away. I hope you guys all enjoyed that. I really enjoyed running down this event, chatting with Dave, hearing that old interview with Brock Lesnar, discussing the match, and of course your feedback. Next week, Wei, what would you like to review, as it is your decision for next week?
Oh, boy. Jesus.
You tend to forget each week.
I always forget. Well, John, considering we are getting into WrestleMania season right now, I think I would like to look at a show that we can very much relate to what's going on in the WWE right now with The Rock's return. And that is WrestleMania 14 with the introduction of Mike Tyson in that Shawn Michaels Steve Austin angle, because we've talked about it before, the build for that match is almost like what they're doing with The Rock now, is a third man who is in a focal feud with one of the top stars. Then it was Austin versus Tyson, now it's Cena versus The Rock.
Very good pick. We will go with a WrestleMania 14 next year from Boston, Massachusetts.
Next week.
Yeah. And to end off things, Wei, I thought, because we are starting, including this show, we are 5 shows away from WrestleMania, if my math is correct, the 5th one being WrestleMania night. So I thought, over the next 5 weeks, we could do a bit of a countdown of the top 5 WrestleMania themes, major bands.
Good idea.
So I don't know how this will work. Maybe, well, I pick 5 this week, and then next week it can be in your court to pick whatever is number 4 in your estimation.
Okay.
I'm trying to make this uncomplicated. But here is my pick for number 5. It is Step Up by Drowning Pool.
Oh.